It's not cruel to slap someone in the head senseless. It's not inhumane to deny someone food and sleep. It's not degrading to put someone naked in a cell at freezing temperature until they're shivering. That's not degrading. It's perfectly normal stuff. Waterboarding. Simulated drowning. Not a problem. It was Bradbury who took the president's signing statement after that congressional law and made sure that it had no basis, that it had no meaning whatsoever. George Bush says we don't torture, but he defines none of the practices he's ever done as torture. And that, my friends, is not just torture. It's tortured logic. That's it for the Inside Scoop today. Tune in tomorrow. For now, there's Bob Kincaid's prayer meeting coming up. This is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. The Dow Jones dropped more than 200 points at the end of trading today. We'll have the final numbers coming up in our business block. President Bush and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will host an international conference with Middle East leaders next week in Annapolis, Maryland. Secretary Rice says she will try to reach a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. However, she cautions that success is not guaranteed. Israel has agreed to release 432 Palestinian prisoners as a goodwill token prior to the November 27th summit. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as early as Saturday, according to a top official. Musharraf will take the presidential oath as a civilian. As the December 2nd Russian parliamentary election approaches, President Vladimir Putin attacked his political opponents. He accused them of being tools of foreign, specifically pro-Western, governments. The BBC reports thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning home. According to Iraq's Ministry of Migration, about 1,000 people are returning daily. Officials say the drop in violence, improved security, as well as incentives from the Iraqi government are responsible for the rising numbers. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown issued a public apology today for a security breach that affects 25 million people in Britain. The two lost computer disks contain bank account and personal information on millions of people, and it is described as the largest incident of its kind in Europe. Former French President Jacques Chirac is facing a formal investigation for embezzlement of public funds when he was mayor of Paris. The allegations stem from a scheme in which city jobs were given to political sympathizers. Chirac denies the charges. The French government and striking transit workers are back at the bargaining table trying to end the 8-day-old strike. Early this morning, striking hardliners set fire to railway cables and signal boxes, causing delays in a coordinated attack of sabotage on France's high-speed railway system. Airports across the U.S. are packed with travelers today. A record nearly 39 million Americans are expected to travel at least 50 miles this Thanksgiving holiday. Michigan's Supreme Court approved the January 15th presidential primary date. Based on this decision, the state of New Hampshire just announced January 8th will be the date of its presidential primary, which is the first in the nation. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Have you ever found yourself swatting at a fly no one else sees? Chances are you're seeing what we commonly call a floater. Many people have them and have had them for a while. Floaters are condensed proteins located in the gel-like part of our eyes called the vitreous. As we age, this gel becomes more liquefied, and so whatever debris was once trapped inside is now freer to float around. They are typically harmless, but you should check with your eye doctor if you notice new floaters, especially if they appear after a flash of light, or if you should notice a curtaining effect of your side vision. Otherwise, that squiggly critter you see, especially when you look at a blue sky or a white background, is probably with you for life and should simply be ignored. I'm Dr. Nancy Eklund.
The preceding message on Eye Care by Dr. Nancy Eklund has been brought to you as a public service by the Quality News Network. For more information, please contact your eye doctor.
According to the Calorie Control Council, on Thanksgiving Day, the average American eats 4,500 calories and nearly 230 grams of fat. Doctors are now saying if you feel sleepy after a big Thanksgiving Day meal, don't blame the turkey. The amino acid tryptophan in the holiday bird is the usual suspect for feeling drowsy, but nutritionists say people at the traditional meal have simply eaten too much. Retailer The Gap reports its third quarter profit was up 26%. However, the company says its full year outlook may not meet Wall Street expectations. The National Retail Federation expects retail sales to grow 4% in November and December. That would be the smallest increase since 2002. A new survey by two consumer groups finds that about 35% of consumers say they will spend less this holiday season than last year. One of the reasons why is the increase in gasoline costs. Gas is now about a dollar more per gallon compared to 1 year ago. Gold is trading at $798.60 an ounce. Light sweet crude is trading at $97.29 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. At the close of Wall Street today, the Dow Jones was down 211 points, the NASDAQ was down 35, and the S&P 500 down 23. There's more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights. They're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! It's Wednesday. It's the pre-Thanksgiving edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. Thank you very kindly for coming along and joining me. Joining us, this happy little family, this merry band that gets together here on the Head On Radio Network most every day. Hope you've got all your Thanksgiving stuff ready to roll. Hope you know what you're thankful for. Hope you know that there are people out there that aren't too thankful and that you can take them into consideration as you, celebrate your own family feast. Why would people not be thankful? Let's start with the Native American community. This ain't a day of Thanksgiving. This is a day of grieving. But, you know, it's not just the day before Thanksgiving. The day before Thanksgiving just happens to always be a Wednesday. And you know what Wednesday means.
On this every other Wednesday afternoon discussion club, we are going to have more to discuss on this every other Wednesday afternoon than we ever had on any other every other Wednesday afternoon.
You're doggone right, because this is, after all, prayer meeting. And that means it's time to come on down to the altar, place your hands upon the subwoofer, and feel the healing waves of audio magnificence a-flowing through you. Hallelujah, glory! I am Brother Bob Kincaid, and you are in the Cathedral of Common Sense. And I hope you will make yourself welcome. So we start this being, and I've got Thanksgiving stuff coming, okay? I mean, all kinds of fun. Right after the beginning of the third hour, we're going to be joined by the Internet's most brilliant satirist, the one, the only, Eugene Finerman of FinermanWorks.com, F-I-N-E-R-M-A-N, Works, W-O-R-K-S.com. And We'll talk about perhaps some of the less touched upon aspects of Thanksgiving. I think you'll probably enjoy them. Just to give you a little taste, I don't want to spoil anything, but Eugene's Your RDA of Irony today touches on this very subject, Thanksgiving. And you might find that entirely interesting. As Eugene notes, the chief of the neighborhood, Massasoit, had the responsibility of getting rid of the Europeans almost 400 years ago. It was getting a little bit difficult to ignore the interlopers, what Tom Tancredo might refer to as the illegal aliens. But I'm not going to spoil that. We're going to have a blast with it, Eugene and I, sometime around 8:06 Eastern Time, I believe. A little bit of storytelling time, being Thanksgiving. It's time once again to repeat my own little family's epic Thanksgiving adventure. This is one of those moments I miss having Agnes producing, because she'd be sitting here throwing pencils at me and things as I tell the story. So don't let me forget to get to that. I had mentioned a reading that I like to do. I wasn't able to find the text online today, so that's not going to happen, but we'll save that for Christmas. Some short fiction by Truman Capote. All kinds of fun stuff lined up for this evening, but, you know, just because it's the night before Thanksgiving doesn't mean that everything grinds to a halt, and it certainly isn't an excuse for us to avoid our prayer meeting obligations here on this Wednesday evening. After the show is over, I've already figured out what I'm going to do. You know, I enjoy cooking a lot, and I enjoy cooking especially when there's danger involved. So I have this nexus, and this happens to me every year. You know, it just does. We got a big family. There's not enough time to put a frozen turkey in the refrigerator for 2 weeks and wait for it to thaw, because we have to have the everyday food of everyday eating in there, and it just doesn't jibe. So I have to power thaw a turkey every year. And this year I think I've come up with my best plan yet. Sometime around 1 a.m., after All Foxed Up has closed out, after I have started the rerun stream that will go from 1 a.m. Thursday morning until roughly, 3 p.m. Monday afternoon, because we are taking the holiday off, with the exception, of course, of Rick's Place on the weekend, as well as Night Sounds with your host, Billy Shears. After I've set up that rerun stream, I'm going to go outside and play with fire. I'm going to take the partially thawed bird, take its plastic wrapping off of it, and I'm going to slowly hickory smoke it to thaw it. Wile E. Coyote, you genius. So we will have a gently hickory-smoked turkey tomorrow for our family feast. All right, enough levity, enough frivolity, off into the mire, off into the muck, off into the general nastiness of a wander through fundamentalist America. What do I have in mind? Well, let's go to the state that from whence I arose. My native soil, if you will, let us go, yes, yea verily, to Alabama. Alabama, where, as we all know, they believe that abstinence only is the only way of teaching children not to have sex. Because, after all, that is what is commanded by the Old Testament. Abstinence only. Thou shalt not have sex without somebody has paid your daddy a goat or several sheep in order to own a woman to have sex with. Because that's what it says in the good book. Well, talk about an underreported lead. Headline, Alabama ranks high in reported STD cases. You know, Alabama. Where they teach that, you don't want to use one of those little latex thingies on your, you know, and because then that's no good. Just say no. Just say no to what the Italians refer to as the poor man's opera, otherwise known as sex. Now, this is an underreported lead. I love it. Alabama ranks high in reported STD cases. The lead line, Alabama fared no better than the rest of the nation when it comes to reported cases of sexually transmitted diseases. No, Alabama fared a lot worse than the rest of the nation because Alabama is chock-a-block with repiglickins and fundamentalists and phony Christians and hucksters and con men and charlatans and politicians enriching themselves at the expense of the ignorance of the garden variety conservative family values voter. The state, golly, Ned, the state ranks fifth in the United States. Alabama ranks fifth in the United States for chlamydia. It ranks fourth in the nation for cases of gonorrhea and, well, Alabama ranks second in the United States for syphilis. Officials with the Alabama Department of Public Health said chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis and the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, are the most frequently reported STDs in the state. The most affected age group for chlamydia and gonorrhea is 15 to 19-year-olds. Dear God. Nothing in here, however, about laying blame where it belongs on the people who have said, you know, just don't have sex. No, 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 we can't do that. We can't actually talk rationally about sex. Yeah, so let's take a look at the rest of, because, you know, let's, no, it's not just Alabama. Heavens to Betsy, what are you thinking? This is fundamentalist born. This is fundamentalist created. This is fundamentalist desired. And it is not something that is just Alabama's problem. No, 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 no. Let's look at the rest of the numbers. You know, I told you that where chlamydia is concerned, and you know what chlamydia is. Chlamydia, well, it can, if it's undetected and untreated, chlamydia can cause things like pelvic pain, infertility in women. The testing is recommended for women younger than 26 years old, women who are pregnant, or women who have new or multiple partners. But we can't be doing that down in Alabama, where all the women's are, of course, flowers of southern gentility. No, no, we, or other places, because after all, Alabama was only fifth with 22,915 cases, or 502.8 cases per 100,000 people. I'll take the penicillin for $1,000, Vanna. Number four, New Mexico. Number three, South Carolina. Number two, Mississippi. And another Republican state, number one, Alaska. You know, I kind of understand Alaska. It stays dark up there a lot. I mean, you know, how can you tell? Gonorrhea. Gonorrhea. Another dandy. Gonorrhea, number five. Why, look, we're back in the old South again. We're back in the land of fundamentalists. Why, we're back in the state where the governor prays for rain. Sonny Perdue, governor of Georgia, and number five on the gonorrhea hit parade is Georgia. Number four, Alabama. Number three, Louisiana. Come on down, Louisiana. Number two, ha, there they are again, South Carolina. And number one, Mississippi. Now, syphilis. Okie dokie. Number five. This might come as a surprise, but it is, after all, well, Maryland. Number four. You'd rather expect this? Nevada. Plenty of Republicans in Nevada. Number three. Hey, look, it's Sonny Perdue again. Come on down, get your little trophy, Sonny, because Georgia is number three for syphilis. Number two, Alabama. Come on down, Governor Bob Riley. You fundamentalist Baptist, you. Come on down and get your trophy for having the second highest syphilis rate in the nation. And number one, Louisiana. Jeepers. Are you surprised? Huh. I mean, far greater population densities in places like Philadelphia, New York City, Chicago, L.A. You know, L.A.'s just full of them brown people, them Mexicans that people like Tom Tancredo hate so much. Betcha he would have expected all those diseases to be concentrated where the people he hates are. Not amongst his fundamentalist brethren and sistren. But no. In states where government takes a proactive response instead of just burying its head in the sand and pretending that young people don't have sex, because, you know, clearly the statistics indicate that this is a function of ignorance. The 15 to 19-year-olds. The kids who have never been allowed to be told in school that you gotta rap the rascal. Other states, they talk about that kind of thing. But not in genteel South Carolina. Or decent and dignified Alabama. Or Mississippi. Nope, we'll just let the brain rotting, never mind. But, hey, look, you know, it's what they want. This is what they want. When fundamentalists talk about objecting to talking about sex in schools and teaching about the human body in school and human body functions in school, this is what they are telling you that they want. Not that they would ever admit that their precious little darling has come home and told them, you know, she's got it. Or that little Junior has come home and asked that seminal question just posed by the late great Frank Zappa, to wit, why does it hurt when I pee? Because we're fundamentalists, we're just not capable of talking about it. We'll pray over it, all right? We'll lay hand. No, I ain't going to lay my hands on it because I don't want to get to two. Dear Jesus. Oh, I have a feeling we're going to have fun with prayer meeting tonight. Let's go to the phones and see who's on the line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good Lord, do you have it going on tonight?
I got it fired up, Jim.
Well, you must have a bee in your bonnet somewhere. Well, look, as far as Sonny Perdue is concerned, if he wants to get on a carpet the size of, I don't know, whatever, a caristan or whatever, and pray, or if he wants to do that, that doesn't bother me. It doesn't make me feel insecure. Let him do it. That's fine. That's his right.
Yeah, it just makes him an idiot.
Yeah, I don't care. This is inconsequential to me. It really is, if he's going to do that. And as far as the sex thing is concerned, I know where you're coming from, okay? I do. And I know you don't support the ignorance and the belief system that endorses not having sex. But you do have to say this. If you don't do the boom boom, you're not going to get it off the toilet seat and nobody's going to get pregnant. I mean, that is, we're talking about 100% Fort Knox security. The trouble is, these people don't practice what they preach.
And they expect, at the fundamental level, Jim, they expect human beings not to act like human beings.
Well, I'm fully aware of how human beings act, because I can tell you, in my youth, I've had some pretty embarrassing situations. But I've had to go to the doctor and get 2 million units over each hip, okay? It ain't no fun.
That's a loading dose.
I will never forget what I was told. Well, is it cystitis or is it the clap? And my dad said, well, son, go out in the back and you get a hold of 2 trees. If you pull up one, it's cystitis. So they both come up, it's the clap.
Wow. Your dad was a physician?
My father was a civil engineer, but he was, he knew enough about the school of life to know, about things like crabs, clap, syphilis, and that type of thing.
And he had the common decency to talk with you about it.
Yeah, we sure did. You know, he said, look, but he did say, I'm going to tell you. He said, rubbers break, and he said, honestly and truly, Jim, he said, you know, the 100% way is just to wait, not to do it. That was just his generation, his school of thought. Of course, he didn't do it, but he felt that it was his duty to pass it on to his son, you know, and I can appreciate his point of view, and I respect it.
Well, look, I mean, that's the thing. It's a tough conversation to have. It's tough enough as it is without having fundamentalists who run the state government beating you over the head, telling you that it's sinful, it's a moral disgrace, to explain all of the story. You know, your dad didn't give you half of it. He told you the whole skinny.
I remember talking to a guy who had AIDS, okay? And he told me that he had used condoms and all this kinds of stuff. And I just asked him, I said, well, what kind of lubricant did you use with that condom? Vaseline. And I said, I didn't say it to him, and I said, well, that's too bad. But I thought to myself, dear God, no wonder, because Vaseline will destroy a condom. It'll dissolve it. No wonder you're sick. No wonder you got infected.
You know,
somebody obviously, and this man was an intelligent person, a highly intelligent person, well-educated. But he did not know enough to realize that when you use these methods like dental dams and condoms and latex, that if you use an oil-based type of lubricant, they're not going to hold up.
And
this is all the way with this thing.
Some of this is fairly difficult to talk about.
Well, I don't find it difficult to talk about because it's life or death.
But there are a lot of people who do, Jim, and that's why there is a place for educational systems to talk about it, for it to be talked about in a circumstance where you can keep the giggling and the tittering to a minimum?
I tell you, Bob, if I were a teacher, well, I was a teacher, but if I were still a teacher and I were having to deal with health or sex or whatever they're going to bring this thing under, I would tell those kids the best way
is don't
have any of these problems is to refrain, to be absent. But if you must, and if your biological urges do get the best of you, as they will, I love my wife, but are you kidding, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Then I would tell them in the most explicit yet delicate way of what they've got to do and how they've got to keep from getting pregnant or keep from passing on something to one another that could kill them.
And see, these fundamentalist governments down south, Jim, have made it certain that second half of the equation that you just described cannot happen in any public institution of learning, be it elementary school, junior high school, high school, or college.
Well, that's just crazy. That's just happened.
But that's what's happened since the fundamentalists have taken over this nation.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, in days of old, I mean, you know, let's face it, you could go to the, you could either go to the drugstore and get some A200 for your crabs, or you could get antibiotics for the, your chlamydia, your clap, or your syphilis. I mean, you could do that. But now we're dealing with a whole different plateau of a disease.
Children can die.
And, you know, the result eventually will be, at the very best, a severe attenuation of your lifestyle, if not your life expectancy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing that people need to realize, and that's the reason, you know, in Africa, it's just out of complete control. And this is one reason.
And the rates are back on the rise in this country, according to something I just read.
Because people have gotten the idea, and I'm not sure which groups it is among. I think it's on the rise among. Is it? I know it is from African Americans.
It's on the rise in the heterosexual population. It's on the rise across the board.
Yeah, there is. I mean, you know, in his
book, and see, bear in mind, I mean, you know, I mean, I talk about them frequently on the show, Jim. I've got kids, right? I got four of them.
Absolutely.
And with each one of them, since they were educated in the state of West Virginia, and this just drives me nuts, every year, from the moment that each of them entered the fifth grade, we have had to sign a statement every year, not opting out, but opting our children in to health and sex education. Parents in this state have a right.
You mean the sexual climate in this state is very antediluvian?
Well, it is that, but it's even more frightening than that, Jim, because parents in this state have a right, and it drives me nuts because it's their kids that might be infecting my kids. They have a right to make sure that little Johnny and Janie fundamentalist don't ever hear anything about the nature of the human reproductive system, about disease transmission, about, you know, basically any health science that has taken place since 1950.
Well, don't these parents of these fundamentalists have a talk with their children about the birds and the bees?
Yes. God made the birds. God made the bees. Don't do it. And that's and that's what they get in their church, that's what they get in their homes, and that is what they try it every year to ram it through the legislature to make sure that that's what goes on in our schools, to the point that we have to take affirmative steps to make sure that our children are actually given a complete educational experience in science class.
So these kids go around getting their birth control in the men's room of the Chevron station.
No, they don't get any at all, and they wind up with HIV, and they wind up with chlamydia, and they wind up with syphilis, and they wind up with gonorrhea, and they give it to because kids have sex, and they give it to the children who have sat in the classes and know better. I talk about fundamentalism poisoning this country. It's infecting this country, and it's infecting it sexually, it's infecting it mentally, it's infecting it philosophically, and it is deadly.
Well, I'm not going to take you to task on any of those issues, that's for sure, but I can certainly understand the need for people to be educated and informed and to, you know, realize that if you cannot be abstinent, then you're going to have to pursue alternate or oblique strategies, which will involve contraception and other means of preventing the spread of unwanted pregnancy and possible fatal disease. You're going to have to be practical. I think what is the AIDS population now? Is it 40 million? I think it's over.
Higher.
Back in 1990, Randy Schultz, before he died, in his book, he wrote two books, Condom and Becoming and The Band Played On, he did predict for right into the 21st century that the worldwide pandemic would surpass in either the middle or late 90s, 40 million. He was right on target there.
Yeah, he was.
You know, it's really a horrible thing too, because when you see the effects of what this disease has done to people, and how it's just wiped out a whole generation of very intelligent people who would contribute to the arts and the sciences and other things as well. It is absolutely heartrending because, you know, this stuff has been around so long.
Jim, I think I was listening to Peter's program, Strictly Confidential, the other night, and he mentioned that scientists have now said that...
Back in the 30s.
1939.
Could be.
You know, is when the virus first made its foray into the human population. And that's just mind-boggling. But you see, Jim, the other side of this, and this isn't just about ranting about the dumbass fundamentalists, because, you know, they are and we all know it, and there's not a lot of point to it. The question that I have to put to people is, how long are we going to pretend that these people are worthy of civilized debate? When are we going to finally begin to look at these creationists, these New Earthers, these intelligent design people, these people who say abstinence and only, and you can't talk about anything else? When are we going to just look at them and say,
well,
you know,
can't kill them?
No, you can't kill them, but you can shut up. You can tell them to shut up, and to get out of the way, and leave room for people who actually want to talk about solving the problem.
Well, you know, you can tell them to shut up, but they're not going to shut up. You know that. The only way that they're going to see the only way they're going to see fit to really see that what you're saying is true is to have a life experience of their own. I would guess. I don't know.
But the problem is, when they have a life experience of their own, it doesn't create a Road to Damascus moment for them, Jim, because their mindset is such that they look up and they think that they are being visited with a plague because they have somehow offended God.
Okay, you've had a lot more experience of these kinds of people, certainly than I have. I really haven't had that much experience with people like that, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, most of these people,
you have talked about your background in this type of religion and stuff like that, and I never had that type of background, mm-hmm. You know, obviously. And it's a little bit harder for me to understand their mindset. But, I mean, you know, hey, it's a free country, and they're going to talk, and they're going to do, and they're going to say, and there's not a whole lot anybody can do about it until they decide to realize that, you know, maybe, hey, everybody is out of step but me, and that's not the case. You know what I'm saying?
Yep, I do. But we're going to have to get serious about it, Jim, or people are going to... You know, especially, you know, when you think about things like syphilis. But I've got a bunch of blinking lights here. Some of them might actually be callers instead of busy signals, so I'll roll on. Thank you, Jim. I do appreciate it.
Well, you have a good Thanksgiving, and, you know, good luck with your Tom Turkey.
I just hope I don't burn him up.
Well, don't do that. What did you say? You were going to boil him first?
No, I'm going to smoke him.
Well, all right.
I'm going to thaw him over gentle hickory smoke.
Well, be sure and take the contraceptive off of him, okay?
Well, yeah, that's kind of job one. Thanks, Jim. Take care. Bye. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Bye now. I tell you what, let's take a quick break. Nah, let's not. Let's keep going. Let's see if any of these are actually phone calls. Nope, you're a busy signal. Hey, who I got?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Who is this?
Kevin.
Hey, Kevin. Happy Thanksgiving, my friend.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
First of all, what we need to do is stop subsidizing these fundamentalists. Having them start paying their taxes.
Right. And stop subsidizing their little money-sucking scams to teach things like abstinence only.
Exactly. You know, I grew up... I don't know if I shared this. I grew up Episcopalian, and I guess it was just my church. But my church also did have a sex education workshop for the young adults,
mm-hmm.
for teens and young adults. And, you know, it was pretty, looking back at it, it was pretty graphic, but basically, and this was a professional sex educator, basically, her statement was, sex is and this is one thing the fundamentals need to understand, sex is a natural part of life. It's a basic human need. It's right up there with breathing, drinking water, going to the bathroom, and eating. You may not need it as much to live as those things, but it's still an emotional, physical intimacy is an emotional human need. Plain and simple.
Yeah. And to Kit, I don't know how to get at this, Kevin. This is a more complicated world, I suppose, than the world, and at least you can make the argument, than the world of 10,000 years ago where it was all hunting and gathering, even though study after study has shown that hunter-gatherers actually had more leisure time than you and I do.
Yeah.
But life, you know, an old man 10,000 years ago was 40.
Mm-hmm.
People live longer, but they still mature sexually at the same rates, and because of all the crap that we put into our world, things like phytoestrogens, they mature. They're sexually maturing younger and younger and younger. It's been identified in the medical literature as something called precocious puberty.
Oh yeah, in Puerto Rico, it was very common. I heard because you know, they said that there was an area in Puerto Rico where women were developing breasts as early as 8.
Yeah,
and
as a consequence of that. With sexual maturity does not come cerebral maturity or physical maturity. It's a throwback to our evolutionary needs from a bygone era.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, because we're dealing with children here, you have to teach them about it, or they're going to go out and try to figure it out on their own. Babies figure things out by sticking fingers in light sockets if you don't cover up the light socket. If we can urge parents to put a little plate on top of an open light the power socket, why can't we urge them to do the same thing or teach their children to do the same thing with their genitals? Surely to God, something that can kill a child, as opposed to just give them a nasty shock, is worth addressing.
Like I said, you know, the fundamentalist world do have issues, and they do have hang-ups with their sexuality. You know, they just do, and they, you know, but like I said, you know, I love it every time one of them break, like the guy in the wetsuit with the apparatus up his bum. You know, I just love it.
Oh, I'm going to have to play that now, Kevin, now that you brought it up.
You know, to me, it's like, because there goes another one, regardless of how much you repress yourself, you know, the truth will always come out. It really does.
Yeah, and how pathetic it is.
Yeah, and you know, it's sad, because I think this would be a much more peaceful world if people were, you know, our friend from Idaho, Senator Craig.
Yes, wide stance.
Yeah, you know, it's like I almost feel sorry for him, because his circles were just so anti-gay, and he couldn't lead the life that he wanted to. That they had to resort to this.
Yeah, but the thing is, Kevin, beyond him, the number of people who can't love the way they want to do, who can't love who they want to, who can't be with whom they want to, because there are fundamentalists like Jerry Falwell, you know, now busily roasting in hell, or D. James Kennedy, also now busily roasting in hell, maybe being sodomized by little demons, if there's any justice at all. You know, those people were out there attacking other people over questions not of lust, not of animal instinct, but questions of love. And there has to be, if there is a hell, there has to be an especially hot and tormented place in the center of that space for people who attack people for trying to love. But the problem we have, Kevin, is that, you know, whether it's abstinence-only education, or, as I said, intelligent design, or any of the other freakish stuff that the fundamentalists want to foist off on the American people, the problem is that we continue to dialogue with them as if they have something to say. We need to learn to treat them like the drunk old dude at the end of the bar that they are.
Yeah, well, again, as the drunk old boot at the end of the bar, if he's carrying a lot of cash, he doesn't become that drunk anymore. Do you understand?
Or he get, or he gets treated like he's not nearly as crazy as he sounds.
Exactly. Money does a lot of things. Money makes people better looking than they actually are, nicer than they actually are, and smarter than they actually are. And as long as these people are funding Republican congressmen, senators, and even Republican dog catchers, they will have a voice in this society. You know, you got to understand, these people, they usually thrive on people who don't have a sense of belonging to anything. And, you know, one of the things I guess I was taught, first and foremost, is that regardless of whatever, your family will always love you and accept you. You will never have to go through any silly initiation rites or anything like that. Be part of this family. You're here, you're part of us, and you're one of us. And for me, I know this is why, you know, these cults or fundamentalists, they thrive on college campuses when these kids are very vulnerable because they're away from home for the first time, and that's where they go. And they usually, a lot of these people end up going to these things or becoming part of these things in their college years or being heavily influenced in their college years.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's the first time you're away from home, you don't, you know, you're physically mature, but mentally you're still a child. You know, you're kind of going through that, and you don't have a sense of, unfortunately, you know, I guess the war in the middle class has been declared so badly that, you know, a lot of parents don't have the time to be parents to remind them, you know, this is your family. Your family.
And yet we're having a reasonable conversation about this, Kevin. At the same time, I can guarantee you, this being a Wednesday, somewhere in the state of Alabama, they're having Wednesday night prayer meeting at the Busted Knuckle the First Independent Holiness Sanctuary for Herpetological Worship and Cyanide Drinking Baptist Church. And they're citing this same report as evidence of the cultural decay of this here nation. It's the secular liberals who have brought this disease upon us. I guarantee it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And the, you know, going back to what I was saying, the thing is, a lot of these organizations make people alienate their families.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, the church becomes your family, or the so-called, you know, because, like I said, I don't even call them churches. I call them businesses. You know, to me...
Well, that's why I call it the religion industry, Kevin.
Yeah. You know, I know what a church is because I think I grew up in a church. A church is more of a community organization, which doesn't monopolize your life. You know, you do what you can, and they're usually grateful, and you give what you can, and they're usually grateful and appreciative. It's really, the focus is on one thing. And they're not looking to dominate or control your life. And, you know, like I said, you and I disagree because I still do believe in God.
Well, no. Careful there, Kevin. You're making some assumptions about me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just, you know, no. I mean, you're not alone. Mark Levine has decided that I'm, you know, the Horn's great atheist. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, okay. Well, maybe.
But I just.
I refuse
to pretend that any answers that I have found for myself are sufficient to serve as answers for other people.
Oh, well, absolutely, and it shouldn't be that way. Matter of fact, it's written in the Bible, you know. It shouldn't be that way. And, you know, it's like as I've become older, you know, I've become more spiritual and other things, and like I said, your definition of spirituality and my definition are two different universes.
Yeah, I mean, I can come up with a great big list of things that I think don't matter, but that's because they don't matter for me. Eating a little, a really, really bland, boring, tasteless, flavorless little salt, the saltine, and thinking it puts me in touch with the deity. You know, I think that's BS. And the same thing for the swig of grape juice.
But I would say that's more of a ceremonial, and it's, you know, reenactment.
Hey, there's a religion out there that thinks that that turns into Jesus meeting your little tummy, Kevin, and
that's
just crazy. That's just nuts.
Yeah, I like to think it's more out of reverence for the Jewish faith.
No, the book says do this in remembrance of me, not do this because it turns you into a cannibal.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the craziness isn't limited to that. The whole bit, when you get into the business of counting angels on pinheads, you've missed the point.
Oh yeah. Well, a lot of that stuff, I don't even buy into it. But like I said, I don't want to have a religious pissing contest. That's not me. But like I said,
nor would I ever.
Huh?
Nor would I ever. Yeah.
Exactly. People nowadays, I have enough confidence in myself. When people come up to me and say if I'm safe, I say yes, I am. And because when they ask you that question, it's usually code. Are you going to my church, though?
Yeah, it's code for are you a fundamentalist?
No, it's code. Not even a fundamentalist. It's code if you're going to my church.
Saved, born again.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I really resent, and it's one of the very few things that I truly resent about the presidency of Jimmy Carter, is that that hateful phrase got injected into the cultural discussion.
Exactly.
When he said that he was.
Yeah. And we haven't recovered from it since.
No, we haven't. We haven't.
Yeah. Even though Carter was an honorable man. And what do you mean was? He is an honorable man. I thank God every day. He's living long enough to see him vindicated for a lot of things. You know. I thank God every day.
And every day vindicates him just a little bit more, Kevin.
More. Okay. Yeah, exactly. He's living long enough to see himself vindicated. You know, now, hopefully, another miracle will happen on December 10th and Gore will announce his presidency. I just want to throw that in because I have a feeling that's when it's going to happen.
Why December 10th?
That's when he gets the Nobel Prize. Physically gets the prize.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And that's where...
I thought there was maybe some sort of fundraising thing or federal election law deadline.
But the stage for him to make the announcement will be physically there if he's going to...
Oh, so he'll be, I get it. He'll be there on the stage in Oslo and make his, okay.
Yeah.
I don't share your optimism. I would not grieve if he did it. I would be extremely happy if he did it.
In honor of the Wednesday prayer meeting, I am praying for a miracle. I'm going to be, and hopefully a lot of people out there will be praying for that miracle. If not, he could pull an Eisenhower and just throw his hat in on there. That could be another option.
True. Yeah. Well, Kevin, I appreciate it a lot, and all set for Thanksgiving?
As soon as I need to be, I'm going over to relatives.
Are you taking a covered dish or anything, or are you just going to sit back?
My mother is, of course. Me, I just will make sure there's cranberry there. there's ample cranberry.
Good
and
deal.
One without the other. Okay. God bless you and everyone.
You take care and a very happy feast, and I hope it's a wonderful family get together.
It will be. It will be.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, bye.
Take care. Talk to you soon. And let's see if there's somebody on this line. Nope, you're a busy signal. I don't know. I wonder sometimes if I'm getting the getting the point across. And look, I'll tell you, I'm confident. I think at least for my purposes, I'm at peace with the universe. Except for, winning the Powerball. But a lot of people aren't. And those are the people who get suckered in by organized religion, whatever religion it is, whether it be some variation of Christianity, whether it be fundamentalism, and fundamentalism of any stripe, be it Islam, be it Christianity. Is there fundamentalist Hinduism, fundamentalist Buddhism? Yeah, I put them in the same bag. But history teaches us that organized religion becomes a means of controlling other human beings. Anytime you're going to find a connection with God, the universe, Yahweh, Allah, the Buddha nature, the flying spaghetti monster, anytime you're going to find that connection, it's going to be a personal connection, and nobody in no suit, no uniform, can find it for you or tell you how to get there. It is a lonely search that you must take for yourself. Isn't it? At least, you know, that's the best that I've been able to figure out. There's no magic. There is, as was it Plato or Socrates? Maybe it was Aristotle that said there is no royal road to geometry. Nope, sure isn't. No royal road to salvation either. Nonetheless, people selling that, hustling that, amass vast amounts of money, pump it into state governments in places where they think the populace will be particularly susceptible, and go about ensuring that children can't find out about condoms, or, to use the previous example, that you can't use a petroleum-based lubricant and a condom at the same time. It would seem like elementary stuff. It is elementary stuff. It's the kind of elementary stuff that should be taught in elementary school. Really. So, you know, that's just kind of, it just seems to make sense to me. But that's not all we have for prayer meeting tonight. No, we've got much, much more. And we'll hit it all when we come back. And don't forget, a little bit of Thanksgiving Eve fun and frivolity. We'll also continue a tradition to close the show about 20 minutes until 9 o'clock Eastern Time. We'll fire up the one and the only Arlo Guthrie with Alice's Restaurant, which used to just be a really cute little song until all the garbage that if you're familiar with the song, you know. All the garbage with which that song deals came roaring back to life when we decided to start a war that we had no business in. So the last portion of the program, we'll run out with Arlo Guthrie and Alice's Restaurant. Coming up right now, however, the news. After the news, more of your phone calls to 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4 head on. That's toll free. If you've got your own plan and you can save us a buck or two, 304-658-5453 or email to bob@headonradio.com. It all works equally well. We'll be right back right here on America's independently operated liberal voice. America's listener-supported liberal voice. The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's only gonna go to waste. We're not really being rude. Put the good stuff's in his closet. I swear he wouldn't mind. Hell, we'll just shoot the lock off. I do it all the time. The gypsy's in the pad. He's left us here alone. The order of the sleepless nights will now assume the throne. We ain't got no money. We ain't got no rights.
stress up there. We got all this fear. We'll free them from their condo. Bring them over here. We'll show them his gold record. Plays music loud. We'll party just like Bubba does. We'll do the old man proud. We're gypsies in the palace. There ain't no wrong or right. We're gypsies in the palace. And of course, wild tonight. He's the greatest guy to work for.
This is the Quality News Network. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as soon as this weekend, according to a top government official. He will then take the presidential oath as a civilian, satisfying a key directive by Western powers, including the White House. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says while she is looking forward to next week's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland, she is cautious about expecting too much from a fragile diplomacy. World powers will gather to promote a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians in order to gain some stability in the war-torn Middle East. Thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning to their homes, according to the BBC. An estimated 1,000 Iraqis make it back home daily because of a drop in violence, improved security, and incentives from the Iraqi government. In Bangladesh, shelters and rescue camps are overrun with victims of the country's worst storm in a decade. Food and water are running out. More bodies are being discovered. Thousands remain missing. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown apologized to the public today for a security breach affecting an estimated 25 million people across the United Kingdom. Two computer disks containing bank account and personal information are lost in the largest breach of security of its kind in Europe. Airports and train stations across the U.S. are packed with travelers today. A record 39 million Americans expected to travel at least 50 miles this Thanksgiving holiday. Ending months of speculation, officials with the state of New Hampshire announcing that their presidential primary will be held on January 8th. Iowa's caucuses have led the way for several decades, but New Hampshire has had the initial primary for even longer, since 1920. The announcement comes on the heels of Michigan State's decision to hold their primary on January 15th. The French government and striking transit workers back at the bargaining table today, that despite early morning sabotage on the country's high-speed rail lines. The strike has crippled France, costing the economy an estimated $500 million per day. Also in Japan, thousands of civilian workers on U.S. military bases striking today to protest a 10% pay cut. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We'll look at science and business news just ahead. But first, this message.
Remember when the name on the door said it all? In today's world, it's the website that defines a company's image. For better or worse, a company's presence on the internet is a vital factor in how it keeps existing customers and attracts new clients. Byte Technology of Monterey is a leader in a new approach to web design. Byte designs a new site based on the mission, purpose, character, and indeed the energy of their clients. Byte is particularly successful in presenting their client's name to the global internet community because they approach the design with a clear, defined process. By fully understanding the client's business, motivation, and operation, they are able to translate the company's critical values into the new website. In addition to original design, Byte works with clients to update their website to reflect changes in target markets, products and services, and the business climate. Byte Technology. See what they're about at byte-technology.com or call 831-656-9178.
University researchers say they've mapped the genetic code for two strains of drug-resistant tuberculosis. Doctors say understanding the way mutations work will assist in the effort to improve treatment of the disease. According to the Calorie Control Council, on Thanksgiving Day, the average American eats 4,500 calories and nearly 230 grams of fat. Centers for Disease Control, meantime, report that American adults are exercising more. However, there is still room for more improvement, according to the particular study. Freddie Mac announcing a massive quarterly net loss of $2.03 billion. The government-sponsored mortgage company saying it was forced to set aside $1.2 billion to pay for home loans gone sour. Construction of single-family homes fell last month to a 16-year low. Commerce Department reporting a significant boost, though, in construction of apartments. Shares of Office Depot falling 6% after it's announced its quarterly profit fell by 9%. World's largest office supply company deciding reduced consumer spending and the housing slump for the decline. Light sweet crude trading at $97.29 a barrel, gold at $798.60 an ounce. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunging once again to close at 12,799. Always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, so let's go around again, and let's not waste any time shilly-shallying, dilly-dallying, or otherwise fooling about. We'll leave that to the syphilitic fundamentalists. On the phone, we have our good friend David calling from Maine. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you?
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
And to you, too.
Yeah. I was listening to what you were saying about fundamentalism. And what people believe, and what people want you to believe, and all everything in between. And to me, I think of it as a larger issue. To me, is once you step to that level, and this is similar to what I say about conservatism too, and also people who have studied and went one way, and they don't want to be looked at as fools. They don't want to look to be as gullible.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be looked at as naive and silly. So they're going to stay with their position no matter what the consequences are. And that's the way I look at everything when it comes from the right.
And beyond that, though, David, it's what happens even if they're confronted with the wrongness of their position, they will do anything rather to avoid confronting the fact that they are just dead wrong. God's mad at me, so, you know, God gave me gonorrhea. You know, God's mad at me, so God made me have a car wreck. I forget who it was that was on the show one evening and pointed out that every time fundamentalists see something that poses a problem for them, that they try to eliminate it for the rest of us. Gambling is a case in point. Liquor, drugs, dirty magazines, so to speak, how people choose to have sex. Look at the business with gay marriage is an attack on the traditional family. You know, there's no traditional families are going to break up if a couple of guys can pick out a China pattern.
You know, Bob, when people, I think people have a hard time understanding why it is people act like this, and I guess I could explain it to people this way. When you don't have that much to be defiant about, when you're in a comfortable position, or when you are in an insulated position from the outside of the world, you need to find something to be defiant about, and that's what they're choosing. And I really think in a lot of cases, a lot of people don't really mean what they say. They just really want to be defiant about something and get emotional and have someone react to something, whether it's in a negative way or if they see it a positive, whichever way, they just want a reaction and attention, really.
It's certainly attention based. There's no getting around that.
It is.
It's infantile.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody, you know, the same crowd that needs to believe that the world was that grass was created before the sunlight that nourishes it. The same crowd that believes that the earth is just slightly younger than the recipe for beer, for heaven's sakes, is a childish crowd. They are childlike. They are mentally deficient, and I don't mind saying it. You know, I've had people say, you know, Bob, that's intolerant. No,
yeah.
It's not. It is not intolerant to say that certain people don't belong in certain discussions because they do not have the mental acuity to participate. You know, I don't invite my children into discussions about things of adult import. You know, there's even a Bible verse to support it. It's something along the lines of, when I was a child, I spake as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things.
Yeah.
You know, you can't invite people who believe that God sends plagues onto individuals to talk about questions of public health.
I understand that, and at the same time, though, like I said, these people have what they've been raised in, what they've been disciplined under. I don't know what I would be like if I had. I'm not even going to begin to guess. I see it all the time on a lot of these YouTube videos. A lot of people put up a lot of these Christian YouTube videos and talk about who needs to be saved and all of this, and you listen to them respond back and forth, and it's like there is no doubt in what they say. This is the way, but. With that comes something that I think a lot of people should realize. If there is no doubt, then why are they saying it so much? There must be this little voice in their heads that says, you know, you could be wrong, so you might as well state your position one more time.
Yeah, just to make, you know, just in case you can con one more human being in.
Yeah, just or you can look at it as just because maybe if I say it a little bit louder, I'll believe it a little bit more today.
Yeah. Well, if you keep hollering it loudly enough, and you know, that's the history of organized Christianity. You know, they just invented a Trinity and hollered Trinity long enough and put it and made it part of the power structure until the Trinity took hold.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't exist in the Bible. Doctrinally, or as any manifestation of reality. You know, the same thing with the virginity of Mary. You know, St. Paul never mentions it. Saint, you know, please. Saul of Tarsus, the half-insane tent maker who huffed a few too many fumes, doesn't mention it.
You know, one of the things that people don't realize, I sent you a link to This Film Is Not Yet Rated. The trailer, of course.
Yeah.
that's going to be that's what I'm going to say after everything. And you know, what's great about that film, for those who haven't seen it, it does delve into religion a bit as well, and the religious control that the MPAA has. Now, a lot of people say, what? Well, the MPAA, and they reveal it in the movie, Bob, and I found this interesting, is they have two clergymen always who are reviewing all of the films that come in, no matter what they are. Try to wrap your head around that one. Why are they there? And then you think about the movies that they accepted and greenlighted to be R, and then see, this is another thing that people don't realize. A lot of movies rest, when you watch the movie, Bob, you'll see the story of Jack Valenti, and you'll see his rise to power, and you'll see these interviews that they cut together. But the amazing thing about the film, to me, of This Film Is Not Yet Rated, is it goes beneath the surface, and it tells you, it shows you the religious doctrine that people are missing that is in the MPAA, the little subtle messages that they put out to the people, the fact that they don't want to reveal their board members and how they shroud them in secrecy constantly. And there really is no answer why they shroud them in secret constantly other than fear, and they realize that they're not doing the right thing when it comes to art and expression and creativity. And the interesting thing about it is what they talk about in the movies that they see as blasphemous, and the notes that they make, like they talk about those scenes that might be offensive to Catholics, might be offensive to Christians, and then they go on and on. There's like an interview with the chairwoman, and they ask about like why didn't this get and they ask specific questions that you never get to ask. And the great thing about the film, and this is why I recommend it to everyone, is because they lift the veil finally, and you get to see the faces of the MPAA. You get to see the religious indoctrination. You get to see.
Well, you basically get to see how the Hayes Commission, which was run by religious freaks, got driven underground and then just sort of bubbled up as the MPAA, and everybody thought the Hayes Commission was gone.
But I mean, people will be shocked you'll be shocked, Bob, when you watch this film, how far they got. They got all the list. You see the faces in the you see the faces and you see the actual laws and rules that they put in place in the book of the NPA. It's insane. I'll tell you this, and this will give you an example of how messed up this organization is. They have more secrecy of who's in their organization as much as the CIA.
Jeez.
And when you watch it, Bob, you'd just be laughing because you'd be like, oh, my God, they lied about the age groups, too? They lied about everything. They don't follow any of these rules. No wonder they don't want anyone to know. And they have, like, you know, they have it so when you come to get your movie reviewed and you walk in, like, you're a producer of film, you can't see the clergyman, but they can see you.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's that kind of craziness, like, and you'll be asking yourself, why does this person have to review my movie? Like, they talk about what they found offensive with Hilary Swank's movie, where she was playing a guy.
Yeah.
And you can see why they would want to make that film an NC-17. You get to see one of the interesting things they do is they take all of the offensive scenes and they collage it together of what the MPAA was very objective about and made into an NC-17. It's a really exhaustive type of documentary, and I really recommend it to everyone. And and what's really revealing is in the beginning, they tell you something that I didn't know previously. Blockbuster does not do NC-17. So therefore, this film is not yet rated because they used those brief clips and snippets of scenes that turned into NC-17, and also it was against Blockbuster's rules and regulations, and also had ties with of the group that they were going after. That's another thing. You start to see all the video chain stores that are tied to the DVD and the film rating system. It's really a powerful film.
It's all information management, isn't it?
Yes. And one last thing before I go, I really think we should talk about it sometime. Is we really need to start talking about that Fifth Fleet in Iran. The reason why we need to start talking about that is because I see all the distractions that are happening right now in terms of the news. I see, you know, some people mentioning it, but I would really like to see maybe some Navy personnel, some people come forward and get their thoughts and feedback on that situation of a whole damn 5,000 people just stuck right on the border, right on the line of Iran of their...
And waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Sunburn cruise missiles and their Yakounts, those kind of cruise missiles that they have. And I would just like to get their take on this. And maybe if someone's listening who is in the Navy, maybe you know someone who knows someone who knows someone who was on that ship. I think it's important we need to talk about it. And if it happens and it's the new Pearl Harbor, we should at least be on the ball and talk about something like this before it happens. And I just wanted to bring that up, and hopefully we can have a more in-depth discussion on it, because I think it is getting sidetracked a bit.
There is every reason to believe that the Bush administration will roll out their war with Iran sometime. Well, again, how many times do I have to say it? I'm not gooning on you, David. You know that.
Yeah.
How many times do I have to say it? These people haven't had a new idea in their entire existence. And as a consequence of that, there is no reason to expect that they won't do Iran on the same basic template with which they did Iraq. They can't start the war in June. They can't do it in August because that would be too obvious, and it's right smack dab in the middle of the political conventions.
Yeah.
They can't. And, you know, it was Rove himself who said, you don't roll out new product in August. We will see the war with Iran sometime around between March and May of 2008. I'm not going to do lead pipe cinch or, you know, I'll march naked down Main Street over it or anything if it doesn't happen, but I'm confident. I'm confident. And that's one of the frustrating things is I can't, you know, I write my congressmen, I write my senators, and I'm not a crank. I patiently explain to them that the only way to derail this plan is to impeach them.
I wonder how many people understand about the significance of the Fifth Fleet being smack dab right in there. It's like a bad game of battleship.
Yeah,
all the pieces are lined up.
Yeah, and if all the pieces are lined up and something awful happens, then, you know, it'll be the same kind of inquiry that we had after Pearl Harbor. You know, how could you guys let this happen? You know, you just park all the battleships in a nice convenient little row so they can get whacked.
Yeah.
But it won't be their fault. I mean, really, they're following orders. We've got the better than half of the United States Navy between the tip of India and the northern end of the Persian Gulf.
I'd really like to be one of those fly on the walls in a lot of these cabinet members in terms of senators and congressmen, and when they're having their daily meetings, and see if some of the people with a conscience talk about this, because I think I've heard Dennis Kucinich, he's one of the only people that I've heard him mention it. Maybe Murtha mentioned it in passing, but again, I mean...
Well, Biden said at the last debate, you know, if he starts a war with Iran, impeach him.
Yeah.
But that's a classic case of closing the barn door when the horse is gone and the barn's on fire.
I wonder if a lot of people are afraid to bring up the Fifth Fleet now. It's
I don't think that they're afraid to. They just don't know, David.
Yeah.
I mean, God knows Katie Couric's not covering it.
And that brings an interesting question. How do you get people that are on a higher plateau to be in the know if they don't want to be in the know? That's the ultimate question.
Willful ignorance. And I don't know that there's an answer to it.
Yeah.
Hey, David, I got a blink in here. I don't know if there's a person on it or not, but I want to find out.
Well, Bob, all I got to say is check out the Martian Child movie with John Cusack, too. It's pretty good.
Okay, cool. I will.
All right, later.
Later, David.
Peace.
Bye now. Happy Thanksgiving. And, gosh, I hope you're still here. Hey, who have I got?
Hello, Bob. It's Michelle.
Michelle, how are you, dear?
I'm doing okay. It's kind of ironic. It seems like I call after David, you know, a lot of times. David and I.
Oh, don't try to con me. You guys are working this stuff out.
I'll call him up and say, David, call him so I can call, and he'll be like deja vu.
Right.
So, what documentary was David talking? I've seen advertisement for it on Sundance, but with the...
This film has not been rated?
Ah, yeah.
And it sounds like a dandy. I mean, I love that kind of thing.
I didn't know it was out. I don't go to the movie theaters. I'm just sickened by the commercials. I just really have a hard time sitting through all the commercials. You know, even if you don't... You know, you have to get there to at least try to get a decent seat where your neck's not kinked, you know?
Well, it's a simple matter of economics here, because at $7 or $8 a ticket, now that, you know, because you have to pay adult prices at the movie theater
once
the children are, you know, a year and a half?
Crawling.
Yeah, no longer crawling. So at $8 a ticket and gas to get over to because, you know, the day of the local movie house, that one's gone too. So it's an 80-mile round trip to the movies. It's $8 a ticket. And, you know, you like to stop for a bite to eat. And, hell, if you take a family my size to, God forbid, McDonald's, you're into $40 there. So let's see. You know, it's a $120 night to go see a movie that is too much of a crapshoot to take the risk.
Yeah, I'm not much of...
And heaven only knows, Michelle, I can't remember the last time I had a night out with my wife. Kind of sad, but true.
You guys really need that, don't you?
Oh, in a bad way, sure. We need time. We need every couple, no matter how many kids, needs an opportunity to remember that there was a reason that they liked each other in the first place, and that's how the kids happened.
Yeah, and you know, it's really hard. I mean, that's a good subject. It's really hard to be in a monogamous relationship. And they don't tell you that. Your parents don't tell you that.
At this point, I don't think to be honest, at this point, I don't think Agnes and I are in a monogamous relationship. Agnes and I are in a non-ogamous relationship. You know, the last...
passing in the hall.
I never told the story, Michelle, But the last time that we tried to have any time alone, you got to understand, this is a 75-year-old house, okay? And the door locks and the doorknobs are still those old skeleton key kinds of locks.
Oh, my God.
Agnes found the key that fits our bedroom door. So, you know, she walks in the room, she closes the door behind her, she gives me that look. You know the look.
The wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Turns around, puts the key in the door, goes click. And, you know, the kids were, like, out of the house playing. You know, we're sitting there. We're like teenagers, terrified of getting caught.
Oh, yeah.
And all is said and done, and she goes to open the unlock the door and walk, and we're locked in. And the lock is frozen. And we're trapped in our own bedroom.
Meanwhile, the kids are killing one another outside.
Or you know, standing outside the door going, what are you two doing? You know, because we got some pretty savvy kids.
Yeah.
So my son-in-law winds up, he stands outside the bedroom window. I slide the double hung window up. He removes the air conditioner.
Oh, no.
Crawls through the window. Takes a pry bar. Well, first we took off the we took the pins out of the hinges.
Right, right.
But the door wouldn't come off that way. So we put the pins back in the hinges, and he takes a pry bar and pries the facing off of the wall so that he can then get in and force the deadbolt to move back. Like I said, it would screenplay up.
God.
It would screenplay up as an episode from Love American Style. It really would.
Yeah, it would give reason for that.
You know, Harvey Korman could play me.
You know, I have to tell you, because my husband, he has two children from his first marriage, and I have one. So together we make three.
Mm-hmm.
And his children every other weekend were with their mother. And then we had little Elizabeth, you know. When we got together, she was 2.5. So on those weekends, the kids were gone, you know, with their mom. We had to figure something out. We don't have any family, mind you, in Southern California to, you know, take care of the kid. So we'd tell her, oh, go have a popsicle. Now it's kind of a joke that she's finally catching on.
Hey, kid, go have a popsicle.
Yeah, even though nothing happens, we just like saying it.
I know, but yes, absolutely. But, yeah. You know, I love the merry little life that we lead. It's just, you know, like I said, at this point, it's non-ogamous. I think I've invented a new word now.
I think it's good material. I really do. I think that, you know, when you really need to bust gut, you know, all you got to do is go back on that material of the married life, the family life, the Thanksgiving dinner from hell. You know, if we can look at that, then that will help us to survive what we all, you know, like I was saying in the chat room that I was really depressed because in the past day, last night I watched, I think it was not Nightline, but it's PBS's.
Frontline?
Yeah, Frontline, thank you. I watched that on Jafar, I don't know how they pronounce it. And then today I watched a documentary on PETA, and also, what was the other one? God, I can't remember, but I'm just, you know, I'm like, okay. I need some material, you know. I need to reflect on my material. And, you know, and then it's prayer meeting Wednesday, and I'm thinking, you know, yes, we all have to be heterosexual families and live with one mate all of our life, and that's the way it should be, and life is just bliss, and, you know, and meanwhile, everybody's abusing, and then you're talking about the STIs now, they call them, you know, sexually transmitted infections. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know they weren't diseases anymore.
No, they're called infections. So, now what that does, I guess, is That's new to me. I heard it from a Planned Parenthood affiliate or a person affiliated with Planned Parenthood.
Well, we have to keep up. By the way, are we still on the nicotine wagon?
Oh yeah, okay. And that 10 pounds, it's sticking to me like.
It gets welded on. Don't kid yourself.
Oh my God, the only benefit is my husband's like, wow, your chest size has increased. Now, mind you, when we met, I looked like I was going through puberty because I weighed 110 pounds, you know. I was lean. Nobody would butcher me. But, you know, it's like, okay, now I'm understanding this age thing, you know. But, yeah, nicotine is no longer part of my life. I think about you often on that matter.
It's all I got left.
I know, but I have to tell you, I hate it. But I sure love breathing. Bob, I have to tell you that.
I know. I've quitting's easy. I've done it a million times.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
yes.
And yeah, wonderful things happen when you do. For me, and you know, calling horn psychologist Dr. Rick Goodner. For me, it's when the nightmares kick in that. I always
lose it.
And they always follow the same form, Michelle. It is, I'll have this dream and I'll be 10 years down the road. And there will be a conversation going on and somebody says, oh, Bob, that's great. You've quit smoking for 10 years. Yeah, I have. You know, I'm clean as a whistle. And somewhere in the course of the dream, I pick up a cigarette and light it.
Yeah. I just had that last night.
Okay, it's not just me then.
It's okay, it's been a while. You can have one.
and I wake up in a cold, ugly sweat. I hate because in my dream I just loathe myself.
Oh, you do?
Because it's like, darn, now I gotta do this all over again and I'm re-addicted. Damn it.
Right.
And you wake up and you're kinda, you know, and it's like, oh, dang. Yeah.
You know, if anything, I just wish that I could get it across to people how non-compassionate our society has become in so many ways. But, you know, okay, we're talking about nicotine addiction. The apathy that society has about, well, you should just quit, you know, and how they're, you know, they just push it off as, you know, oh, you're weak and, you know, that's just a nasty habit. When they have no idea as their, you know, their credit card is maxed out because they have a shopping habit that, you know, they'll starve their kids, you know, so they can have those shoes or, you know, what I'm saying is, they're working out and they're wearing that fashion makeup that you can work out and you have to chisel it off, you know, afterwards, or, you know, the guy's driving his Hummer, and, you know, which is a name I never understood except, you know, being phallic.
That's mainly because it is.
And to see a woman driving a Hummer. Anyway, but yeah, it's just ironic. And then try to have a relationship, whatever it be, you know, same sex, opposite sex.
No sex.
Yeah. You know, it's just sex.
Yeah.
Trying to get that done. You know, you got to figure that into the, you know.
You know, when it finally gets a place on the to-do list, then you know you're done.
Oh, yeah.
Change the cat box, grocery shopping, get the garbage out, clean out the garage, have an intimate moment. Yeah. When it has to go on a list, no pun intended, you're screwed.
Well, you know, your oldest daughter, I enjoyed chatting with her in the chat room.
She's a gem.
Why don't you have her host the night? and tell us all about, you know, you guys. And
no! No!
Oh. You'd have to perform.
No! What are you trying to do to me? Oh, yeah, what is
this? I'm trying to help Agnes out.
Yeah, what is this? Poke Bob with a sharp stick night? Oh,
I miss you guys.
Well, we're just so glad you're there.
Oh, I'm glad you guys are there. I love you. Do you have another call?
I got a couple stacked up. Three out of five are probably busy signals, but you know, that's my life. You know, no screener.
Well, we like that though. It's kind of like a game. You know, it's a gamble. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, in the room, everybody in the room. Let's start betting. Okay, I'll put a nickel on that call's dropped. Or
all right, Michelle, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you soon.
Give them all hugs for me.
Sure will.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, is it a busy... okay, everybody got their bets down? Is it a busy signal? No, it's not a busy signal. Hey, who have I got?
Is it Twoo, Bob? Is it Twoo?
It's Twoo, it's Twoo.
It's Twoo. Is it really Twoo? I don't have much to say, but, you know, and I don't mean to be offensive.
Oh, wait a minute, Jim. Wait a minute. Let's have it straight from the horse's mouth.
Oh, it's Twoo. It's Twoo. It's Twoo. It's Twoo.
Yep.
Oh, but she's so tired. Let's face it, I'm just tired.
You know, I wish I had the Love American style theme after. If Agnes gets wind of the fact that I've told that story, my life will not be worth a plug nickel.
You know, I had a friend who had the exact, who had the precise answer to the thing about sex. And he just looked at me one day and he said, you know, one thing about masturbation, you certainly don't have to look your best.
What did Woody Allen say? I remember this. I remember the first time I ever had sex. I was alone at the time.
Yeah. You know, when you think about, I will never forget one episode of Roseanne when little DJ was turned 13, and mm-hmm. he had locked himself in the bathroom, and of course his sister Darlene comes in. She said, "Well, DJ has finally found a friend that's not imaginary."
Oh, where is this show going? This was the Thanksgiving show. What have I done, Jim?
And then she said, well, he's been in there for an hour, which he's proved either he's real good at it or he's really bad at it. That show did a lot of stuff for a lot of people, I think. And I thought, you know, it did it in a good way. I love Roseanne. I know we're going, you know, skipping away from a lot of topics and stuff like that, but, you know. Honestly and truly, that show did an awful lot to teach people about a lot of things. I mean, she was the blue-collar baby, and this, that, and the other. She could be crass and vulgar, and this, that, and the other. I just love her, and I still do. I still catch every episode that I can. I think I've seen every episode of that show at least 3 to 4 times. I'm a certified Rosenologist.
Yeah, that's where I am with the Andy Griffith Show.
Well, that's a little... Aunt B is a far cry from Roseanne, but none.
And God knows I can quote most of the lines that Jethro Bodine ever uttered. What we need is a little motivation. You know, I was just over on the Brando lot, and they're just swimming in it. That's what we need, motivation.
Absolutely. But, you know, I want to talk to you just about cigarettes for a second.
That's all right.
My love affair with nicotine. During the day, now, see if this isn't crazy. I have no desire to smoke at all. None. If I'm around somebody smoking a cigarette during the day, I have to get out of there. It makes me sick. But when it gets dark and the armies of the night begin to march, well, when you have a cocktail in one hand, well, guess what goes with that cocktail?
Oh, you're darn right.
And isn't that an odd thing? I have no desire to smoke during the day, do not smoke during the day, but at night, I will fire a couple of them up.
Well, I've got a, you know, the truth of the matter is I've got a short list of when a smoke is really good. With a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
After an intimate moment.
Yeah, well, good.
Or several of them. Cigarettes and moments. And with a drink.
Well, absolutely. Like the three best things in the world. A cocktail before and a good cigarette after. So there it is. But anyway, I don't have much to add other than that. I'm just rambling here, but the way that the thing was going, you were talking about cigarettes and talking about other urges that we have. I mean, you know, we're human. We do the best we can to control them. And, you know, nicotine addiction is a serious problem. It really is.
It is the most. I've never been. I mean, I freely acknowledge my addiction, and I've never known anything like it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in this life that I have tried, and I've walked away from 99% of it.
Well, I quit for years, and the way I quit was I used Hall's Mental Method cough drops.
My mother used Brock's butterscotch discs.
Well, there's something about that Hall's Mentholistic cough.
Well,
or something.
To be fair, Jim, she used Brock's butterscotch discs and malignant breast cancer, and that quit her off cigarettes in 1973, and she never, you know, now and you know, occasionally I'd be around, she'd say, you know, that thing smells good.
Well, when my mother quit, she never started back. She always had to have a pack with her.
Well, my father went to his grave saying, you know, I want a cigarette a foot long.
Well, hey, look, you know, if you can make it to 80 or something like that, I think you're doing pretty damn good. You really are. I mean, we're only promised 3, 4, and 10. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like the old George Gerson thing. Methuselah lived 900 years, but who calls that living when no gal was given to no man with 900 years?
Well said, Jim. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Bye now. Okay, two more blinking lights. Place your bets, place your bets. The wheel goes round and round. Is it a busy signal? It's a busy signal. Let's try again. Oh, that looks like a person.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, is this Preston?
Yes, it is.
Hey, welcome to the program. Happy Thanksgiving.
Likewise, definitely.
I think I think the program's gotten a little bit silly, but we'll survive, maybe.
Silly is good. You were talking about cigarettes, and it made me think of a friend of mine who spent a year in Syria recently, and he brought back this big water pipe.
Oh, a hookah, yes.
Yeah. And he brought it by, along with the kind of tobacco that they smoke in it, which is tobacco plus kind of like there's dried fruit in it.
Yeah, they blend all kinds of stuff in it, don't they?
Yeah, so you've tried it before.
Yes, I have. And it's amazing.
I thought it was real nice. I liked it a lot. The way they burn the tobacco, too, it's interesting. They don't put the flame right to the tobacco, but they heat up that... You know, they just get those coals going and kind of heat it up and almost vaporize it, kind of like. I don't know. Did you notice that?
Yeah, well, you do that in a hookah, and frankly, if you're real persnickety about a cigar, you do the same thing. You never let the open flame actually touch the end of the cigar.
Okay.
Because this is from the same obsessive compulsive crowd that makes a martini and talks about, you know, not shaking but stirring instead because you don't want to bruise the gin. I've never seen bruised gin, but you know, it certainly worked for me.
Okay. Interesting. Have you ever tried those kind of all natural, or they're called all natural cigarettes? I think they're called American Spirits.
I have on a number of occasions, and if I could afford them, that's all I'd smoke.
Okay.
But at $6 a pack, and considering the nature of my habit, it just doesn't happen. But they are kind enough to send me, I get a $10 coupon every month or so from them, and I run right out and use it to get two packs. And of course, it costs me an extra $2 because they're $6 a pack. But yeah, oh, that's wonderful stuff.
Okay.
And I don't smoke menthol cigarettes, but I've even tried those, and they're yummy. And they've even got a flavor. Oh God, what is it? Perique. It's a fermented tobacco that's made in small batches in Louisiana. And they've got a blend for that just is out of this world. If you're a smoker, boy, oh, I feel terrible now, Preston, because I'm encouraging people to smoke. Oh,
you know,
they're lighting up the barbecue pit in hell for me, Preston.
You know, it's something that human beings have been doing for quite a long time, and I think it has its place. I think it's a shame that so much of the tobacco is grown, well, that they put in all those chemicals, I guess dozens and dozens of chemicals these days.
Look, you can light up a typical over-the-counter cigarette, and you can light up a good Dominican or Honduran or even Cuban cigar. They don't even smell the same.
Okay. Yep.
Because they're not. What happens to create an American cigarette shouldn't happen to a dog. Because they take the tobacco, and they grind it down to powder, and they add all these vile chemicals into it, and they make, well, it's like a paper-making process. They make a paper out of it, and that's how they manipulate how much nicotine is in it, because they're manipulating your habit along the way.
Yeah.
And once they've made the paper, then they re-shred it and turn it into cigarettes, and that's why you can leave a cigarette burning in an ashtray, and it'll go and burn all the way down to the filter, while a cigar will go out, and so will one of those natural American spirit cigarettes. They go out.
Yeah. Yeah. I just recently, I think in the past couple of years, some of the companies have put an additional spike of nicotine in their cigarettes.
Yeah, just to give you that refreshing burst of flavor.
Right, there you go. It was interesting during that movie, Supersize Me, when the person was going on the McDonald's diet for a month, he mentioned a sensation of becoming addicted to it. And one, you know, you wonder if they don't put things in their food to make us desire them more.
Or if they manipulate the thing, that I don't think they're putting anything additional in to make us get hooked on it, but there are certain things that human, you know, I mentioned earlier the fact that we are living longer lives, but we still have Stone Age physiologies.
Yeah, we could live
and we crave fat because
sugar.
Fats and sugars were the least available things in the hunter-gatherer diet. You know, I mean, if you think about it, you chase down a deer, you kill the deer, you eat the deer, no fat.
Yeah.
You know, you get a little bit of sugar out of fruits. I mean, the reason the human body will not store vitamin C is because vitamin C was readily available when we were in the trees. Reach over and have a lemon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's oversimplifying, but there's some truth in that. And what they do is they prey upon it. And then, you know, then there's the discussion about things like high fructose corn syrup. I'm so serious about that stuff that I've actually sat down and talked to my kids, but I've actually shown my kids labels in the grocery store. I'm trying to turn them into label readers.
Good.
And I said, you know, this, whenever you see these words, high fructose corn syrup, know that you are dealing with garbage that is bad for your body. It'll roast your Isles of Langerhans. It'll screw up your insulin production. Because more and more evidence is pointing toward this stuff as almost a sole cause of the rapid increase in the diabetic population in this country.
Yep, that's right. And that's great that you're talking to your kids about that stuff. I mean,
yeah, they think I'm a geek, Preston.
Yeah, yeah, but still.
But that's my job. I'm dad. I've got to work the geek factor.
Yeah, and it's activism. You know, it's the most important kind of activism.
And that's kind of what chapped me when I had that story last night about Walmart and the country of origin labeling. Can you imagine that as American citizens, we don't even have the right to know where the turkey came from we're going to put on the table tomorrow? We're just left to assume that it came from some happy little industrial turkey Auschwitz somewhere in mid-America?
Right. I mean, free markets. They're always talking about free markets, but if there were such a thing, it would involve that sort of information.
Well, Preston, if I can't make an informed decision about the stuff I'm buying, I'm not participating in a free market because I am not a free purchaser.
Exactly. Exactly. We're not being given the information to make our choices, informed choices. It's a real shame. Actually, I was just listening to a story on Democracy Now about these crucifixes that were being made in some horrendous sweatshop.
Oh, I've got the story in my stack right now. And it was one of those things. Sometimes I run across stories, Preston, that I think, oh, man, this has got to make it to the show. But then, you know, I read further, and I usually give things, you know, two or three or four reads just to sort of let them get down into the cellular level in my soul.
Yeah.
And I've read it like six times, and I get a little bit madder every time, to the point that I'm afraid that if I bring the story up, I'm just going to wind up sputtering at the microphone. Yes, crucifixes, you know, with the bloody Jesus hanging on it, you know. Granted, he gets a loincloth, because we can't imagine a naked Savior, even though everybody was crucified naked. The Romans weren't nearly so squeamish as we are. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these things manufactured in sweatshops in China, where people work 15 hours a day making Jesus for pennies on the hour.
Yep. And not only were they not sharing place of origin information, they were deceiving people about it. They put made in Italy on some of them anyway. And the Charles Carnegie, this incredible sweatshop, anti-sweatshop crusader, talked about how they're selling them like the crazy Eddie have crucifixes. You know, we will not be undersold. All these crosses must go. And
I must be crazy for selling crucifixes this cheap.
Exactly. But anyway, thankfully they were busted by Charles Kernighan, and, you know, they're scrambling.
And I don't want to take anything away from what Mr. Carnegie has done, and I'm not. But am I overly pessimistic, Preston, when I suspect that for every one of these that get busted, there's a dozen out there that aren't?
It's a huge problem, for sure. Were these being made in, was it Vietnam or was it China?
China.
You know?
The story I've got says China.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I'm sure there are more in Vietnam and in Haiti and... Yeah.
And what I hate is the fact that I know that there's a fundamentalist out there somewhere, Preston, who is saying, well, maybe they're gonna come to understand the saving grace of Jesus Christ by working in that sweatshop.
They'll say that. They'll also say, well, at least we're giving them jobs. They had nothing before. You know, I mean, we're so ignorant of other cultures and
We don't bother to ask things like, I mean, we just assume that, you know, oh, look, they got a couple of billion people in China. And, you know, we make assumptions, and they're really, really bigoted assumptions, Preston. Things like, well, you know, they were just sitting around till we brought the industry over. No, they weren't. They were, in fact, peasant farmers, what we'd call in the Deep South dirt farmers, subsistence farmers. And they lived in places... Because, again, it's something we don't talk about. They lived in places along the route of something called the Three Gorges Dam.
Yeah.
Massive, massive, ancient geographic areas that supported tremendous populations for centuries upon centuries, and subsistence farming. And, frankly, there's no sin in subsistence farming. The only sin in subsistence farming is found by the globalists who see a subsistence farmer as a waste of slave labor.
That's right. And somebody who's independent of, you know, what they're selling. You know, they don't want people to be able to grow their own food and maybe develop their own little markets, their own little local markets, and grow stuff without their pesticides, and their grow meat without antibiotics and steroids. And
now, by the same token, I don't get too terribly romantic about it. All of that is true. I also recognize, however, because it comes from my own history to a certain extent. I've mentioned it a couple of times. When the three Kincaid brothers came over from Scotland, they were the sons of a very prominent, very well-respected publisher. I mean, you can look up all kinds of famous titles in English literature, and you'll find that it was published by Alexander Kincaid the first time through. Well, it was his three sons who had to flee to the United States, or the colonies, actually, to get away from the crown because they backed the wrong horse in the revolution. And within three generations... Those three sons of a publisher, within three generations, their progeny was illiterate. Because all they had time for was subsistence farming.
Yeah. Well, interesting. And, you know, subsistence farming, being a peasant, a campesino, an indigenous person, you know, maybe it's not our thing. Maybe it's something that we wouldn't favor for ourselves or how we've been acculturated or grew up, whatever. And not to romanticize people of other cultures. You know, they've got their own issues and so on and so forth. But, you know, viva la difference, you know, and for us to impose our system, you know, it's classic colonial thinking. You know, we're going to liberate them by introducing them to our fantastic ways of progress. And, you know, the Vietnam War very much was about restructuring that society. I mean, people often say that we lost that war, and in some ways...
Go look at the children chained to the sweatshops and tell me we lost. We got exactly what we wanted.
Cheap labor, having access to the resources, destroying what would have been a model of a different way of being in the world. And the cultural devastation, I mean, in places like Laos, they bombed this area, the U.S. Air Force, the Plain of Jars, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this huge area, and there are these old giant jars that people aren't sure what they are used for. Maybe storing food, maybe liquor. People don't know, but archaeologists to this day can't go and study these things because there's so much unexploded ordnance around them.
It's not the Plain of Jars anymore. It's the Plain of Bomblets.
That's right. Cambodians have to teach their children, they like, be careful, these shiny metal objects. And it's so sad. They even teach them these songs, like these nursery rhymes about don't pick up the metal object. Every month, people are dying there. Farmers run into these unexploded bombs.
But we can't be bothered with that, Preston, because we're in the middle of a global economic miracle.
Right. A miracle for the bomb makers and for Monsanto. You know, 18 million gallons of Agent Orange we dumped on Vietnam alone. 18 million gallons. It's interesting. Recently, there wasn't a word about it in our liberal media, but just in the past couple of years, some Vietnamese had taken the case to court to try to get some compensation like our veterans had to do for so many years. And the Vietnamese were doing it themselves. It was thrown out recently. Forget the excuse, but they're appealing it. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. And now Monsanto is developing, you know, new markets in Colombia to fight the so-called war on drugs.
Look what happened with Chiquita Bananas, Preston. We're kind of up against the top of the hour, but we need to take a couple of minutes for this because we haven't really touched on it on this program or any other on the horn that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Look at what happened with Chiquita Bananas. They just went into federal criminal court, Chiquita Bananas, and pled guilty to hiring terrorists to slaughter, intimidate, torture, murder people who cut bananas out of trees and pack them into boxes. The Bush administration didn't send anybody to jail. They didn't punish any of the corporate hierarchy who made conscious, intentional, willful, with malice aforethought decisions to hire terrorists. They just fined them $250,000 and said, you know, don't do it again, okay?
Right.
And Chiquita said, okay, we won't. And of course they will. Yeah. And this story gets repeated time after time after time. It's coal miners in Colombia. It's banana plantation workers in Honduras and Guatemala. You know, I'm making can I take a topic and run somewhere completely else with it? I'm sitting here I'm talking about the Chiquita story. Every Thanksgiving, I make banana pudding. It's one of the desserts that we have at Thanksgiving because we all love it, and I've got my own little particular variation on it. And I stood at the grocery store early today, and, okay, Chiquita, I don't want Chiquita. Dole. Oh, yeah, there's some good people. And right. I went over to the organic section. No organic bananas today, thanks. But if there had been organic bananas, they were going to be $2.75 a pound.
Yeah.
The dice are loaded. The wheel is rigged. And if I want to do something as simple, and, you know, this is the family holiday. This is our blessed feast. This is something we Americans do that nobody else does. Nobody else has a Thanksgiving feast. Yeah, right. And it's supposed to be, you know, we gather together to eat the dry turkey and over the river and through the woods. To grandmother's house we go, and we throw the weakest member to the wolves that are chasing the sled.
Yeah, other countries have their Thanksgiving weeks, you know, celebrations.
Yeah, we get a day.
Right.
Yeah, and don't think you're getting off work Friday, Buster. You be back here, or you get the pink slip.
I'm going to work Friday.
Yeah, and I can't even make a stinking banana pudding that isn't just larded up with the corporate greed, bloodshed, and guilt. And I got to keep this one to myself. You know, it's not the I'll tell the kids after Thanksgiving.
Right. It's hard to balance all that stuff.
Yeah, sure. And the boy Ferg looks at me and goes, "Will you put the pineapple and the coconut in it too?" And I'm sitting there inside my own tiny little tormented skull, Preston, going, "Yeah, I can put the blood, sweat, and tears of another oppressed class in the banana pudding too, boy. You betcha."
Right. I wanted to mention that. I saw that film that David was talking about. This film is not yet rated.
Mm-hmm.
I received it a couple, probably 4 or 5 months ago. It was the monthly selection from the Iron Weed Film Club. It's kind of a progressive, they distribute kind of progressive independent films that are kind of easy to miss. And I found that interesting. And also, Michelle mentioned a documentary on PETA. PETA and the co-founder Ingrid Newkirk.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. It was on HBO, and I'm not a vegetarian myself, but I think I respect that choice for sure.
I feel like I'm being herded toward it.
I've cut back on my meat consumption drastically for sure, and the meat industry, they can't stand that. I mean, that's they're losing a 3% in their revenue or whatever, and so they really go after PETA big time. But
well, who was it? Was it Oprah a few years back? I mean, Oprah, multi-billionaire Oprah, that was driven to her knees and forced to apologize by the American Beef Producers Association? Oprah.
Right. She had Howard Lyman, a former rancher himself, and big meat eater who became a vegetarian and saw all the chemicals. And in fact, he tells the story of changing his father's ranch from like a family-run traditional style farm to this, you know, he said, "I went to school and I learned how to make it more efficient and make it more moderate and started to pour chemicals in it and turned it into this huge and hugely successful money-wise multi-head mega feedlot," and he was in thinking holistically at the time, and but he had some experiences with his own health, and he started to look into what was going on here, and now he's a vegetarian, and he's been talking about mad cow disease and all that stuff, and yeah, it was on Oprah that they were talking about that, and Oprah made the mistake of saying, "I'm not going to eat another hamburger," and that's, yeah, she said that, and they said, she caused a drop in our stocks or whatever, and yeah, took her to court, and amazing, amazing case. But Howard Lyman keeps pressing on. He just published another book called, I think, No Bull or something like that. And, you know, we have a lot of people out there who are, although we don't see it on Fox or CNN or so many other major outlets at the grassroots, there are all these figures like Howard Lyman and groups like the Iron Weed Film Club that are creating a different sort of media.
Well, I'm going to go and look up the Iron Weed Film Club, Preston. That sounds intriguing. That would be a couple of hours a week or a month, you know, well worth spending.
Yeah. Me and Peter Godbold,
mm-hmm.
we're both fans of Netflix. And, you know, it can be very expensive to go out to the films. And but I found that very useful to be a member of that. It's like $16 a month or so, and you can get a bunch of movies in that time. And I have found, even though it's a big corporation and everything, I found some documentaries there that I just wasn't finding anyplace else. And they also are putting part of their funds into the production of some very good, challenging films. They open their own kind of production wing called, I think, Red Stripe Films or something like that. and they're putting out some very good material. So there are some things to be thankful for.
Indeed. Preston, yeah. you bring so many great ideas and so many great issues to the table. I really appreciate you calling in. If I'm going to keep on the schedule that I've established for this evening, I'm going to have to run away and do the news now. But thank you so much. And, you know, sorry you have to go to work on Friday. You'd think that, you know, the American economic juggernaut could spare a stinking Friday, but I guess not.
No, not this time, but... But I've got tomorrow off, and I'm going to be enjoying that. So enjoy your Thanksgiving.
Indeed,
as well.
And to everyone you love and everyone you care about, please pass our warmest regards.
Great, I'll do that.
Take care, Preston.
Bye-bye.
I turned down the wrong thing. There we go. I just love the stuff that Preston brings. So we'll take a little break for some news. We'll come back, and there's still some stuff on the table to get to. And I expect we'll be talking with our good friend, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, Eugene Finnerman, when we come back. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. Hi, what do you think of that? Thanks, Billy.
Love, love, love. Love American style. Truer than the red, white, and blue.
This is the Quality News Network. A pre-holiday plunge on the Dow. We'll have the numbers coming up in our business segment. Meantime, airports and train stations across the U.S. packed with travelers today. A record 39 million Americans expect to travel at least 50 miles this Thanksgiving holiday. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says while she is looking forward to next week's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland, she is cautious about expecting too much from a fragile diplomacy. World powers will gather to promote a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians in order to gain some stability in the war-torn Middle East. Thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning to their homes. That's according to the BBC. An estimated 1,000 Iraqis make it back home daily because of a drop in violence, improved security, and incentives from the Iraqi government. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as soon as this weekend, according to a top government official. He'll then take the presidential oath as a civilian, satisfying a key directive by Western powers, including the White House. In Bangladesh, shelters and rescue camps overrun with victims of the country's worst storm in a decade. Food and water are now running out, more bodies being discovered, thousands still remaining missing. Ending months of speculation, officials with the state of New Hampshire announced that their presidential primary will be held on January 8th. Iowa's caucuses have led the way for several decades, but New Hampshire has had the initial primary for even longer, since 1920. The announcement comes on the heels of Michigan State's decision to hold their primary on January 15th. The French government and striking transit workers went back to the bargaining table today. President Nicolas Sarkozy warning saboteurs of the country's high-speed rail lines that they would be punished with, quote, extreme severity. The strike has crippled France and is costing the economy an estimated $500 million per day. In Japan, thousands of civilian workers on U.S. military bases are striking today to protest a 10% pay cut. Their paychecks are paid by Tokyo, which has long attempted to cut costs for that particular program. And according to the Calorie Control Council, on Thanksgiving Day, the average American eats 4,500 calories and nearly 230 grams of fat. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Science and Business News is next.
Looking to find the best in the USA? Come to Boulevards.com. We're the best address in city guides across the U.S. For the best information in travel, Boulevards.com gives you the most up-to-date choices for the best in dining, hotels, entertainment, adventure, and exciting tips to make your holiday the best it can be. Whether you're a local or just looking for great getaway tips, go to Boulevards.com and get the best. Be independent of search engines. Make your choices. We're Boulevards.com. Come visit us at SanFrancisco.com, SanJose.com, Carmel.com, WashingtonDC.com, PaloAlto.com, Seattle.com, Oakland.com, SanAntonio.com, Denver.com, and many more. We are Boulevards.com, the best in your visiting the USA. Come visit us at Boulevards.com.
British scientists have discovered a 390-million-year-old fossilized claw that indicates prehistoric bugs were far larger than previously envisioned. The ancient sea scorpion is thought to have been at least 8 feet long. The Centers for Disease Control report that American adults are exercising more. However, there is still room for more improvement, according to that study. Freddie Mac announcing a massive quarterly net loss of $2.3 billion. The government-sponsored mortgage company says it was forced to set aside $1.2 billion to pay for home loans gone sour. Construction of single-family homes fell last month to a 16-year low. However, the Commerce Department reporting a significant boost in construction of apartments. Shares of Office Depot falling 6% after it announced its quarterly profit fell by 9%. The world's largest office supply company cited reduced consumer spending and the housing slump for that decline. Retailer Limited Brands blamed unseasonably warm autumn weather for poor sales and a 48% plunge in quarterly profit. The Ohio-based company lowered its financial outlook. Light sweet crude trading at $97.29 a barrel. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow Jones plunging 211 points to end at 12,799. NASDAQ down 34 points. The S&P 500 down 23. More at our website, QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
All right. And as promised, our good friend Eugene Finnerman of FinnermanWorks.com, FinnermanWorks.com, the Internet's most brilliant satirist, is, in fact, awaiting on the line, and I'll bring him on in just a moment. I want to take care of a couple of, just a little bit of business first, if you don't mind. I got an email in. You know, I get emails. Saying, I would teach my son, and I did. I raised a radical lefty. I would tell him why we don't eat bananas anymore, talking about me and the conversation with my boy. And why not just tell him why you adjusted the menu? I tell my kids a lot. I'll never forget the day that my daughters wept as I explained to them why I wouldn't buy them any Mary-Kate and Ashley products. And I explained to them what happens to the little kids chained to the tables. And I got in big trouble with Agnes. I think the phrase was, "Let them be children, Bob." And so, you know, that informs a little bit of it. And there will be time, and there will be time, and they will be informed. But I can't take it away all at once. And frankly, I can't raise bananas here. I can't raise oranges, lemons, limes. I can't raise kiwi fruit. And to some degree or another, because of the nature of the world in which we live, there is a level of blood and cruelty. I can buy dolphin-safe tuna, but I can't buy a cruelty-free banana. I respect PETA. I'm glad they did the expose here in West Virginia that showed the non-union, underpaid, overworked staffers getting their taking out the frustration they would ordinarily reserve for a boss by, slamming chickens into walls. Glad they did that. Kind of put me off the kernel, if you know what I mean, because those chickens were going to Kentucky Fried. Or, I'm sorry, it's just KFC now, because I don't think in at least Great Britain they're not allowed to refer to what they sell as actually being chicken. So, yeah, I do tell them. But I try not to, you know, I try not to tell them before dinner. And we're going to just... They know enough already as it is, and I'll continue to give it to them, but I'll give it to them judiciously. Because otherwise you can just send people run screaming away, and they won't want to read labels anymore, and they won't want to pay attention to this stuff. You can overload. So, you know, there's that. And coming up toward the end of the program, like I said, we'll also have Alice's Restaurant as a traditional thing. Another thing, the telling of the Kincaid family great shopping escapade of years past. But right now, as I said, the Internet's most brilliant satirist joins us, Eugene Finnerman. Eugene, thanks for taking time to talk a little turkey.
I'm delighted to be here. I want to give thanks to having a disciple like you. I just need 11 more.
and we start a new religion, right?
All right, well, I'll settle for a cult.
Okay, well,
competing with Hare Krishnas, we'll be better dressed.
Better dressed, but hopefully equally well funded.
Now that'd be the Unification Church. I'm not. Is such a thing as a left wing version of a Unification Church? Well, anyway.
No, because being lefties, we can't agree. We can't agree on what we're going to have for lunch, let alone a doctrine or a dogma. But you have taken considerable pains to lay out some of the history of Thanksgiving, and instead of passing along the usual, they wanted to live in peace and stuff. No, that really didn't obtain in history, did it, Eugene? This wasn't about living in peace with the illegal pale immigrants, was it?
Well, we look at it from two perspectives. The first is that, okay, molded by grade school lessons and Hallmark commercials, we reverently refer to those brave pioneers at Plymouth as our pilgrim fathers. Of course, if we actually did file a class action paternity suit, most of us couldn't prove it. Furthermore, we really wouldn't want to be related to them.
I wouldn't want to live next door to them.
That's, ironically, you're the one far more likely to be related than I am.
There's that.
But the fact you're absolutely right. The Pilgrims were a bunch of 17th century Jerry Falwells. And they were the loony fringe of the Puritans. You know, compared to them, Oliver Cromwell was a liberal softy.
Well, okay, let's try to, Eugene, let's stop right there and see if we can't put that in modern terms. There are Baptists. Jerry Falwell, for instance. And they're nuts. These guys were the Fred Phelps crowd. And really, Fred Phelps would be right at home, and you know who I'm talking about, right?
I believe so, yes.
This is the guy, the preacher that goes around to soldiers' funerals saying that the soldier died because God hates fags. And you know, I mean, that's the sign that he holds up. I'm not trying to offend anybody.
You can get AIDS from listening to Tchaikovsky, exactly.
Right, and even the loonies disavow him. But that kind of hatred would be absolutely not only welcome, but joyously celebrated among the so-called Pilgrim Fathers, wouldn't it?
I mean, we were taught that these Pilgrims fled religious persecution in England and Holland. In fact, they fled religious tolerance in those countries. Think of that. They fled religious tolerance. I mean, Pilgrims could not abide other Protestants except the equally morbid Presbyterians. You can only imagine how they regarded Catholics.
Yeah, the morbid Presbyterians, those are my relatives, Eugene.
The Scotsman, yeah.
Yeah.
But the Pilgrims wanted nothing less than a theocracy where only they had the freedom of worship. In England, however, the Anglicans seemed unwilling to persecute themselves. I mean, who could understand that? And Holland was even more depraved. It tolerated Catholics and, gasp, Jews.
Not the Jews.
Isn't that, talk about sectual depravity.
Ba-dum-bum.
And that was the Pilgrim's idea of hell. Not my puns, but just, religious tolerance.
Although we could put them on the list.
Probably. Well, it's a form of torture anyway. And the Pilgrims were everyone else's idea of obnoxious. If the Calvinist bigots wanted a theocracy, England did have a practical solution. In the most generous way of saying good riddance, the crown offered the Pilgrims their own colony in North America. Thousands of quiet miles from England, the fanatics would be free to bore and bully. And if they survived, then
And
God
that's a big if, the if they survived part, that's a big if.
That is.
And the crown was probably counting on that not necessarily coming to fruition.
You know, they couldn't really lose. If they survived, then God and England had a new colony. And if they didn't survive, well, we still shouldn't think that the crown was actually rooting for the Indians.
Even if they were.
Be indiscreet.
So,
These were the, you know, I call them the Grim Pill Fathers.
you know, not the most color coordinated bunch, unless.
Oh,
you know,
no, I disagree. They actually were.
Well, monochromatic sort of way. In a monochromatic sort of way.
Yes. Black, navy blue. Anything that actually hinted of, you know, color, vibrancy was suspiciously Catholic. Which is why they had a war on Christmas, by the way. That seemed just too festive to be, you know, suitably. You know,
that's true, and you know,
acceptably Protestant.
I know. Our good friend Peter Godbold from Strictly Confidential is actually keeping up with the number of days remaining in the war on Christmas. We've only, we've only got a few weeks left in which to crucify a Santa Claus or burn a Christmas tree upside down or some such. I'll watch the chat and see if maybe Peter can tell me how many days yet remain in the war on Christmas. But you're absolutely right. Apart from what I pointed out last night, to wit, that all the business about you can't find Christ on a Christmas card anymore started out in 1920 with Henry Ford and some of the most filthy anti-Semitic screeds ever printed in America. The original war on Christmas was waged by so-called Christian fundamentalists, right?
Precisely, the Calvinists. When Cromwell was ruling England, Christmas, you know, the practice of Christmas was, the celebration of Christmas was prohibited. I mean, even John Milton thought that was a little extreme.
And when John Milton thought something was extreme...
Yeah, he was not exactly, you know, a party animal himself.
No, it wasn't on the A-list.
No.
So, did they eliminate Christmas, or did they just make it into this doer time of sitting down and doing extra Bible reading, or what?
The holiday itself, the birth of Christ, was observed in solemn prayer. You know, anything that would, you know, hint of festivity, however, was ungodly.
I saw you smirk. You're going to burn tomorrow.
No, that was a Catholic trait. No,
oh,
the hanging.
Hanging, yeah. Pressing, yes. Pressing's good.
Yes, I mean, for some reason, burning was a Catholic, the auto de fés were a Catholic monopoly. You could burn in hell, but not on earth.
Right, and it was raised to either high or low art under the Inquisition. But coming back to Thanksgiving,
of course,
Eugene, we're taught that the first Thanksgiving, you know, the Indians show up with all this yummy food.
I have my suspicion.
Yeah, you ever seen the menu?
I practically, you know, could have written it because it's just the foods that I hate and that any person with functioning taste buds would dislike. That was the Indians' plan. You know, as chief of the neighborhood, it was Massasoit's responsibility to get rid of the Europeans. They just couldn't be ignored. The Hurons to the north had tried coexisting with their intruders, those who seemed to call themselves the Mon Dieu. But the poor Hurons ended up being enslaved to strange rituals, serving red wine with muskrat but white wine with pelican.
Jesus.
If these Europeans were so meticulous about food, Massasoit would use their obsessive quirks against them. He would convince these aliens that the local food was disgusting, so they might as well leave.
Nothing to eat here. Move along.
Plotted the most inedible menu and then brought over the abominations as gifts. The main course is what the tribe called mutant chicken. None of the locals would eat anything that ugly. For a side dish, there were bog berries. You know, those tongue-shriveling fruits, they were said to be healthy, but most people would prefer scurvy. The most laughable squash and roots were passed off as delicacies rather than weeds. Finally, and most cruel of all, the Europeans were served maize. We know it as corn. That alone should have sent the Europeans fleeing home for dental floss. But to Massasoit's amazement, these Europeans were impervious to this awful parody of a meal. He had failed to realize that these were different Europeans. Yes, the mon Dieu would have been horrified, but these aliens were called English, and they had no taste buds or teeth. But they were here to stay.
Oh, my God. And you know, we think about, in all seriousness, Eugene, we think about the vast majority of the world diet now comes from the New World. And, you know, as obnoxious as it may have
sounded. You're absolutely right.
And wheat, you know, and barley and stuff. But no, corn fuels the world now, too.
Corn, potatoes.
Tomatoes, chili peppers, sweet bell peppers, on and on and on. So as a consequence, the one thing that Massasoit probably didn't take into consideration was that these people had been subsisting for about 15,000 years on turnips and onions and garlic and the occasional sheep. So what he brought over probably looked pretty darn good.
Oh, they would have had, in England, the diet, you know, everything would have been boiled. That was the height of English cuisine, but either that or burned. Let's see.
There is,
basically, deer, anything they could catch. That wasn't, you know, that they'd get away with poaching. But primarily, remember, bread was literally the staff of life.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything else was the side dish.
Everything else was what you dipped the bread in.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, from your forebears to mine, the meal was what you managed to do with bread. So when they showed up over here, and of course, you know, the first Thanksgiving comes around. By the next Thanksgiving, there's no feast. Because, you know, the Indians, Native Americans, the Hurons, part of the, is this too early for the Iroquois Confederacy?
Possibly not too early, but the wrong location.
Yeah, yeah, true.
That would have been closer to New York. Here you're talking about the Narragansett, if you're talking New England, you're talking about the Narragansett, the Pequot,
the Quahog,
the Sacamores, I think, is another name.
Yeah, yeah.
Massasoit's particular, group was something called the Wampog.
Right, right.
Shouldn't you hum the Jeopardy theme while I'm doing this?
Does it help?
The Hurons were in the north, and, you know, they'd be a Canadian.
True.
Alliance there.
So what you have, and you know, all the fraud that gets passed off. I had a darn good time absorbing last year, and my books have a way of disappearing. I got to find it again because it's time for a reread. I've referenced on this show a couple of times a book by Charles C. Mann called 1491, and he goes into exhaustive detail of what the lifestyle was of Massasoit's people. And the people that surrounded them, and yeah, they squabbled amongst themselves. But you know what, Eugene? They lived in paradise. They really did, honest to God, live in paradise. If something didn't eat you, there was very little disease going around. They lived to more advanced age than the white people who came there. And quite interestingly, one of the frauds that gets passed off on school children is Squanto. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, of course. I even endured the movie.
In other words, no.
it's true.
Walt
Disney wouldn't lie to me.
No, never. That mouse means well. No, Squanto had actually been kidnapped and made it all the way to Spain, hadn't he?
Yes.
And worked his way back to England and back across the Atlantic, only to find out that the tribe from which he... if you're a kid and you're bookish, sooner or later you will wander across James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans.
Mm-hmm.
And long before there was ever a Last of the Mohicans, there was a Last of the Pequods or the Wampawags, because Squanto was it. Squanto wasn't even his name. I wish I had the book at hand. But by the time he makes it back to England, his entire tribe is dead. Because
smallpox is very effective.
It is indeed. And you know, it leads you, I don't want to go too far afield. Man, where does the time go, Eugene? But weapons of mass destruction? Saddam had nothing on George Bush's and my direct forebears. We wiped out, what?
90% of the pre-Columbian, you know, within about, from the period of Fort Columbus to within a century, about 90% of the...
And that's
American
a population that is now...
wiped out.
Yeah, that's a population that is now estimated somewhere on the order of having been around 26 to 35 million people.
Well, I think it was more than that.
You're right.
I think it was closer to... I think they talk about the population of Latin America being about 100 million, and within a century it was down to about 10. And most of it, although the conquistadors were none too gentle, even they couldn't kill that many. It was the smallpox.
It was the smallpox. It was the measles.
I mean, we swapped germs. They gave us syphilis, and we gave them smallpox. We obviously got the better deal of the two.
Yeah, even if it turns out that...
I mean, no one has fun catching smallpox.
Well, there is that. Well, Eugene, what is on the plate at the Finnerman home for Thanksgiving tomorrow?
I imagine it's going to be the usual fare. I'll you know be with my wife and her family.
Oh dear, I didn't know.
And since she's probably within ear range, I can't really give you details about the family, but I can tell you it'll be a traditional fare. We'll be serving turkey, cranberry, stuffing. None of the things I really like, you know. Help me God, if I'd been at Plymouth in 1621, I dare say the only Jew there, I would have tried ordering out for Mexican.
Not Chinese? I thought you guys were notorious for your passion for Chinese.
It's true, we do. But, you know, I mean, Moses spent 40 years in the desert trying to find a decent Szechuan. But the fact is that, I mean, we're also reasonably practical, well, as practical as being Jewish can be, and you just, you know, I mean, obviously Mexican food was closer than Chinese.
Well, and you still would have been out of luck even with the traditional table there, Eugene, because the other stuff that was on there were oysters, shrimp, and lobsters.
Well, actually, I like shrimp, so, you know, I'm a Reformed Jew, so, and my dietary habits, they are closer to Leon Trotsky's, yeah. But,
I didn't know there was a Trotskyite Reformation.
Some ridiculous woman once asked, who's not a relative, once asked me where I went to the synagogue, and I said, B'nai Trotsky.
Well, you know, here in Charleston...
Only because I was trying to offend her, by the way.
Yeah, here in Charleston, we have something similar. It's B'nai Hillbilly. You know, and it's the... I think it was the basketball coach for the University of Tennessee, a gentleman by the name of Bruce Pearl, who said, I have come to Tennessee, and I am living in the middle of the Jew's dilemma. I'm in the land of free bacon.
Well, remember, the Confederacy had a Jewish Secretary of State a century ahead of the rest of the United States.
That is true. Benjamin...
Judah Benjamin.
Yeah, Judah Benjamin. I knew there was a Benjamin in there somewhere.
Yes, indeed. See, which just explains why I'm so confused by, you know, rap music when they say looking for the Benjamins. I always assumed there was allusion to a Jewish family.
Yeah, just down the street.
Yes.
Eugene, I wish you a very, very happy Thanksgiving. I always love our conversations. Don't be such a doggone stranger, will you?
Well, I want to thank you and also your listeners for only burning me an effigy. And, you know, wish you all a happy holiday.
Well, thank you very much. And,
and I'll be eating ice cream as soon as I get home from Thanksgiving, so I'll have something digestible.
I'd load up at breakfast or something before you go over the river and through the woods and all of that stuff.
Just don't like turkey, and I'm normally a glutton, so.
Yeah, I know.
I've heard of all the wonderful things you're doing with the turkey, and.
Well, you know, and I got an email. You'll be interested to know. One of your readers, as a matter of fact, shot me an email right after I mentioned the fact that I was going to try to thaw the turkey by hickory smoking it.
Hmm?
Subject line: Got peanut butter? You try that turkey smoking approach, and you just might need a whole bunch of peanut butter and some serious jelly inventory. Because, you know, the implication being ain't going to be edible. I'm blessed here because you talk about giving thanks, Eugene. I'm so fortunate here. I've got the audience that spends its time and shares its time with the Horn are people who get a rise out of the kind of stuff that you write, who pay serious attention to the world around them, and aren't afraid to learn about and laugh at the foibles of our human existence from time to time. And you know what? That makes my job just downright easy.
And for me, it's very therapeutic, too.
This is my 3 hours on a couch every night. And speaking of 3 hours on a couch, I understand you'll probably need it when you get home tomorrow. So, you know what? I'll be thinking about you. And please give our best to your lovely wife and note that I didn't say anything untoward.
You never do. She worries about.
Yeah, I can get away with it.
You shouldn't encourage me.
I'm out of reach. Yeah, I
okay,
right.
You take care. Happy holiday to you.
And to you too, Eugene. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. The Internet's sharpest satirist. If you are not signed up for your RDA of irony, why aren't you? If Eugene charged you, would you be more likely to? No, just sign up. You get these little gems every day. Today, Eugene did an extended explanation of King Charles of Sweden, who I think got his rear end handed to him on this day in 1711 or 04 or something. And wow. You're not going to get it anywhere else on the web. I'm sorry, you're just not. And that's one of the things that makes the Internet so doggone brilliant. And makes having Eugene on the Internet even more so. Eugene is probably good for a 20-point rise in the general IQ of the Internet. Let's put it that way. So we are fast approaching the end of tonight's program. Two things remain on the agenda. I'll take care of the one first. And that is to tell you that once upon a time, when our babies were little, I think our eldest would have been maybe 11, which would have made or 12, okay, which would have made the next one down 6, followed by 4, followed by 3. Yeah, somewhere around in there, maybe 13, 7, 5, and 4. Yeah, that's probably more like it. Yeah, about 7 years ago. 6 maybe. So 14, 8, 6, and 5. That's perfect. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. 14, 6, 8, and 5. And I had managed to convince Agnes. It was this night. Okay? And it was before I went back into radio. And I had gotten home from my daily job of screwing some of the most hurting people in this state for a living. And I enjoy cooking the holiday meal. And I said to Agnes, you know, load up the babies. Let's go across the river and grocery shop together. God knows we don't get to go out on dates or anything like that. The least we can do is enjoy this time together, and we'll go grocery shopping as a family. She protested. Driving over, she looked at me and she said, "This is not a good idea." "Oh, come on, lighten up. It's the night before Thanksgiving. We'll have fun." I should learn to trust Agnes's instincts. So we went into, it was Kroger's. We went into Kroger. And of course, there were 4 of them and 2 of us. We were from the outset outnumbered. And we started our orderly, you know, I've got a grocery shopping list about as long as my arm, because it wasn't like, you know, we got most of the stuff. And no, I was going to do it all in one evening. And we started our orderly progress through the produce, you know, going the way that the grocery store sort of drives you. You start out in the produce and you make your loop around, up and down the aisles. And my boy is rambunctious, if he is anything. And for a long time, not so much now, but still a little bit, for a long time, people assumed that our two youngest were twins. And where one went, the other followed. Now, the two eldest stayed right, because we, you know, just burned it into their brains. Stay with the group. And they did. On the other hand, Ferg and Doodle, well, they had their own agenda. And they knew that they were going to work it. So they began doing wind sprints up and down the aisle. Agnes left the buggy. Agnes chased them down, brought them, you know, herded them back to the group. And we continued down another aisle and up another one. They took off again. You got to understand, a grocery store aisle is nothing if it is not a temptation to just go at a dead run for little kids. Just like, you know, you were always taught in grade school, you know, you can't run in the hall. Why not? It's the perfect place to run. And so they did. And I think it was three times or so that Agnes gave up. She got what we refer to in this family as Klingon head. Because that means her brow has furrowed so much that she actually gets that sort of turtle-shaped thing going in the center of her forehead that makes her look a lot like a Klingon warrior queen. And she was disgusted. And it was cold outside, and she had on her long overcoat. Beautiful. Because she is. And she said, listen, I'm taking these two. We're going to go and sit in the car. You take the two good children and shop with them and teach them how to shop and do the Thanksgiving thing and have fun. We're going to the car. Oh, honey, don't do that. Don't be a spoil sport. Come on. I mean, they're just kids. No, they're going to break something. We'll wind up having to pay for it, and I'm not going to have myself embarrassed, and I'm not going to have you embarrassed. We're going, and you know, trust your judgment. Okay. So Agnes and I part company. She taking Ferg and Doodle, and me left with the two eldest, and we proceed to shop. Oh, we linger over this turkey and that turkey. We stop in the spice aisle to make sure that we've got sage. There's no sense in even trying to do Thanksgiving dinner without sage for the dressing. A couple of big packages of cornmeal for plenty of cornbread to go in the dressing. You know, you gotta have celery. You gotta have this, you gotta have that. Big bag of potatoes, tons of butter. Pie shells, pumpkin. I think I did a cheesecake that year, so there was cream cheese to be gotten. And all the while, I was utterly, in typical husbandly fashion, clueless of what was transpiring elsewhere in the store. Because Ferg and Doodle did not want to leave. They were having the time of their lives sprinting up and down the aisles. And they were wailing. And they were screaming. And they were crying. They were doing all the things that when other people's children are doing it in a grocery store or a department store, you look and you go, what kind of parent are you? Well, you know, when you are a parent, you find out that, you know, you really don't have any control over this. This is them working you. This is them testing their boundaries. This is them seeing what they can get away with. And they weren't going to get away with it with Agnes. One child in one, by one hand, the other child by the other. And walking toward the front of the store, at which point my children, who are related to me and to Agnes, and therefore are quick of wit and quicker of mouth, Once they saw other human beings at the front of the store, each following the other's lead, or in some sort of circular logic, flopped onto the ground and screamed, "Let go of us! Let go of us! You're not our mommy!" Now, this was before September 11th, but it's still, you know, we got children on milk cartons and things like that, so strangers take that kind of thing seriously. "You're not our mommy! Let go of us, you awful woman!" And to this day, to try to get Agnes to talk about what went through her mind at that moment, she sputters and frequently becomes speechless. So a worker at the grocery store, meaning well, hears these cries from these obviously adorable, well-scrubbed, beautiful little children. And my poor, darling, flustered wife stands there until a member of the local police force comes over to interrogate her. Two members of the local police force, as a matter of fact, one younger, one older. "Ma'am, are you these children's mother?" "Yes." "Do you have any identification for them and for you?" "Yes." "Look, you want to arrest me? Arrest me. Believe me, it'll be a relief. I'll get 3 hots and a cot, and my husband can deal with these little monsters." At which point the elder policeman grins a little bit and chuckles, and Joe Friday, the younger one, is still, you know, he's still very serious, and he looks over and goes, "Hey, you know, and you don't have kids, do you?" "Well, no." And the older cop looks at the younger cop and says, "That's the mother. I know nothing about this." The two eldest and I finish our shopping, wheel our bags out to the family truckster, where Agnes is weeping, and tells me, "So help me God, if I ever go anywhere with you and these two again, it'll be a long, long time." "Well, honey, what's wrong?" "Don't ask." "Don't ask." Stupid me, I continue to ask, and she finally just lets it all go. It took weeks to get over that. Only now can we look back on it and laugh, and it is one of those if you look back on it, you'll laugh kind of things. But there was nothing funny about it at the time. But that is, in fact, our Thanksgiving adventure. One day I'll give it a better ending. And now, just to wrap it all up, the ultimate in Thanksgiving stories, never mind Indians, never mind turkeys. No, there's a massacre.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago. It was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant. She lives in the church nearby the restaurant in the bell tower with her husband Ray and Sasha's a dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile's better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obie, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking to Obie for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obie could have done at the police station, and the first was that he could have given us a medal for being so brave and honest on the telephone, which wasn't very likely, and we didn't expect it. Another thing was that he could have bawled us out and told us never to be seen driving garbage around the vicinity again, which is what we expected. But when we got to the police officer station, there was a third possibility that we hadn't even counted upon, and we was both immediately arrested, handcuffed. And I said, "Obie, I don't think I can pick up the garbage with these handcuffs on." He said, "Shut up, kid. Get in the back of the patrol car." And that's what we did. Sat in the back of the patrol car and drove to the, quote, scene of the crime, unquote. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this happened. Here they got three stop signs, two police officers and one police car, but when we got to the scene of the crime, there was five police officers and three police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in a newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster, tire track, footprints, dog smelling prints, and they took 27 8x10 color glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, and southwest corner, and that's not to mention the aerial photography. After the ordeal, we went back to the jail. Obie said he was going to put us in the cell. Said, "Kid, I'm going to put you in the cell. I want your wallet and your belt." And I said, "Obie, I can understand you wanting my wallet so I don't have any money to spend in the cell, but what do you want my belt for?" And it said, "Kid, we don't want any hangings." Said, "Obie, did you think I was going to hang myself for littering?" Obie said he was making sure, and friends, Obie was, because he took out the toilet seat so I couldn't hit myself over the head and drown. And he took out the toilet paper so I couldn't bend the bars, roll the toilet paper out the window, slide down the roll, and have an escape. Obie was making sure, and it was about 4 or 5 hours later that Alice Remember Alice? It's a song about Alice. Alice came by and with a few nasty words to Obie on the side, bailed us out of jail. We went back to the church, had another Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, and didn't get up until the next morning when we all had to go to court. We walked in, sat down. Obie came in with a 27 8x10, covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back each one. Sat down. Man came in, said, "All rise." We all stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures. And the judge walked in, sat down with the CNI dog, and he sat down. We sat down. Obie looked at the CNI dog. Then the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the CNI dog. And then the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and began to cry, because Obie came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice and there wasn't nothing he could do about it. And the judge wasn't going to look at the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow, but that's not what I came to tell you about. Came to talk about the draft. We got a building down New York City, it's called Whitehall Street, where you walk in and you get injected, inspected, detected, infected, neglected, and selected. I went down to get my physical examination one day, and I walked in, I sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning. Because I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. Man, I wanted to feel like that. I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York. And I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, they gave me a piece of paper, said, "Kid, see the psychiatrist, room 604. And I went up there, I said, "Shrink, I want to kill. I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. 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 Kill." And I started jumping up and down, yelling, "Kill. Kill." And it started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down, yelling, "Kill. Kill." And the sergeant came over, pinned a little on me, set me down the hall, said, "You're our boy. And you feel too good about it." Proceeded on down the hall, getting more injections, inspections, detections, neglections, and all kinds of stuff that they were doing to me at the thing there. And I was there for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. I was there for a long time, going through all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, and I was just having a tough time there. And they was inspecting, injecting every single part of me, and they wasn't leaving no part untouched. Proceeded through, and I when finally came to see the very last man, I walked in, sat down after a whole big thing there, and I walked up and said, "What do you want?" He said, "Kid, we only got one question. Have you ever been arrested?" And I proceeded to tell him the story of Alice's restaurant, Massacre, with full orchestration and five-part harmony and stuff like that, and then all the phenomena stopped me right there and said, "Kid, did you ever go to court?" I proceeded to tell him the story of the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and stopped me right there and said, "Kid, I want you to go over and sit down on that bench that says Group W. Now, kid." And I walked over to the bench there, and there's his Group W, is where they put you if you may not be moral enough to join the army after committing your special crime. And There was all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly-looking people on the bench there. Mother rapers. Father stabbers. Father rapers. Father rapers sitting right there on the bench next to me. And one, it was mean and nasty and ugly and horrible and crime-fighting guys are sitting there on the bench. And the meanest, ugliest, nastiest one, the meanest father raper of them all, was coming over to me, and he was mean and ugly and nasty and horrible and all kinds of things. And he sat down next to me and said, "Kid, what'd you get?" I said, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage." I said, "What were you arrested for, kid?" I said, "Littering." And they all moved away from me on the bench there, and they carry eyeball and all kinds of mean, nasty things, till I said, "And creating a nuisance," and they all came back, shook my hand, and we had a great time on the bench talking about crime, mother stabbing, father raping, all kinds of groovy things that we were talking about on the bench. And everything was
and fine. That's where we have to draw to a close. Thanks, everybody. Catch you Monday. And love those loved ones you're around, and love them well, and be thankful for them. Peace. And always, always, we think of you. RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
This is the Quality News Network. The 2008 Democratic presidential race is tightening, Barack Obama gaining on frontrunner Hillary Clinton 6 weeks before the first balloting. That's according to a Reuters Zogby poll released today. Ending months of speculation, officials with the state of New Hampshire announcing that their presidential primary will be held on January 8th. Iowa's caucuses have led the way for several decades, but New Hampshire has had the initial primary for even longer, since 1920. The announcement comes directly after the state of Michigan's decision to hold their primary on January 15th. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says while she's looking forward to next week's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Annapolis, Maryland, she's cautious about expecting too much from a fragile diplomacy. World powers will gather to promote a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians in order to gain some stability in the war-torn Middle East. Thousands of displaced Iraqis have begun returning to their homes, according to the BBC. An estimated 1,000 Iraqis make it back home daily because of a drop in violence, improved security, and incentives from the Iraqi government. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf may leave his military post as soon as this weekend. That's according to a top official. He'll then take the presidential oath as a civilian, satisfying a key directive by Western powers, including the White House. In Bangladesh, shelters and rescue camps overrun with victims of the country's worst storm in a decade. Food and water now running out. More bodies are being discovered. Thousands remain missing. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown apologized to the public today for a security breach affecting an estimated 25 million people across the United Kingdom. Two computer disks containing a bank account and personal information are lost in the largest breach of security of its kind in Europe. Airports and train stations across the U.S. packed with travelers today. A record 39 million Americans expected to travel at least 50 miles over this Thanksgiving holiday. And the French government and striking transit workers went back to the bargaining table today. President Nicolas Sarkozy warning saboteurs of the country's high-speed rail system that they would be punished with extreme severity. Strike has crippled France and costing the economy an estimated 500 million euros daily. You're listening to QNN.
Living our lives in a civil fashion is a declaration of intent. It says we are ready to put our better selves forward for the well-being of the community. It's like romance. When you fall in love, you are on your best behavior. The delight in making a loving connection with someone brings out the best in us, naturally. It is natural to acknowledge our fellow human beings with a nod of the head or a smile,
to show them the respect we would want them to show us. The more we are civil with strangers and with those who already know us, the healthier a spirit we create for ourselves, for each other, and the surrounding community. George Washington, the founder of a great nation, declared, "Every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present." Civility is essential to community health. For more information, click on the Civility button on our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com.
University researchers say they've mapped the genetic code for two strains of drug-resistant tuberculosis. Doctors say understanding the way mutations work will assist in the effort to improve treatment of the disease. According to the Calorie Control Council, on Thanksgiving Day, the average American eats 4,500 calories and nearly 230 grams of fat. The Centers for Disease Control, meantime, report that American adults are exercising more. However, there is still room for more improvement, according to that study. Freddie Mac announcing a massive quarterly net loss of $2.3 billion. Government-sponsored mortgage company saying it was forced to set aside $1.2 billion to pay for home loans gone awry. Shares of Office Depot fell 6% after it announced its quarterly profit fell by 9%. And also retailer Limited Brands blamed unseasonably warm autumn weather for poor sales, a 48% plunge in quarterly profit, the result there. Abercrombie & Fitch posting a 15% boost in quarterly profit. Even sales were fairly flat at comparable stores. Light sweet crude oil trading at $97.29 a barrel. Gold at $798.60 an ounce. At today's close of Wall Street, the Dow down 211 points to end below 13,000 at 12,799. And there's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 76 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, November the 21st. If you are listening as shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Wednesday, that is the 21st, you are indeed listening to a live show. This show is the eve of Thanksgiving. I was wondering about that earlier. You know, it's almost like science fiction. If you went to another planet and discovered a civilization that all ate the same animal on the same day and gave thanks, you'd probably think it was awfully strange. But, you know, it's a tradition. What can I tell you? I'm participating in it tomorrow myself, and I hope everyone has a safe and wonderful Thanksgiving Day tomorrow. The telephone number for the show is 877, the number 4 head on. That's 877-4 head on. It translates to 877-443-2366. This is indeed Conversation Radio, and you're welcome to call in and talk to myself and to the guest who I'll be introducing in just a moment. If you have unlimited long distance, please use 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. 3333, that rings in West Virginia, and it will save the studio over the toll-free line. If you have unlimited long distance, that would be great. If not, we'll certainly pay the freight. The email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the show if any questions or our listener comments come along. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the past shows, and to the chat room, which is active as I speak. You'll find links there to the main Head On Radio Network site. You can find out about the progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. You'll find the contribute button there. It's a PayPal button on the headonradionetwork.com main page. You'll find links also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, which will assist you in locating music for the show. Our guest this evening was actually our guest Monday evening. It's just that, and it's D.C. LaRue. I'm thrilled to have him back again. It's just that I talked to D.C. so much about his history and how he got in the music business and this, that, and the other, that really we only got to play one of his tracks while he was with us on the air, which was his track called Cathedrals. After he left the show, we played Forces of the Night and Indiscreet, and I'll tell you, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Just to remind you, if you are not with us Monday evening, and you're certainly welcome to go back and listen to the show from Monday, it's archived at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll find a link to the archive within the calendar date, within Monday's calendar date. D.C. LaRue was born David Charles LaRue in New Haven, Connecticut, and studied graphic design in college, and then went into the album sleeve design business. He designed album sleeves for John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, Janis Ian, and a long list of folks. He saw that as a way of getting into the music industry through the back door, because he's always wanted to be a singer. I think that's very clever. His album work and graphic designs won him two Paul Revere Awards. When D.C. LaRue did go into the music business in about 1976, his first smash was Cathedrals, and it prompted Cashbox magazine to say that Cathedrals is to disco what blue suede shoes is to rock dance halls, and there's a lot of history there. He's also the only 12-inch single to be charted on Billboard magazine's top 100 singles chart before or after. So without any further delay, D.C., welcome back to the show this evening.
Thank you. It's delightful to be back.
I'm glad to have you. Yes, I can hear you fine. And you can hear me too?
Sure.
Good.
You know, with the cell phones, they fade in and out. I'm just concerned that you'll hear everything I say.
Thank you
for having me back. I enjoyed the chat we had the night before last. It was really a delight, you know, because you asked some really nice questions and I had some good answers, I guess, you know. Really, I'm really an honest person. At my age, I just cut right to the chase, you know. I had a friend of mine who was listening. He said, "Boy, you just go on, and you're so honest." I said, "Well, you know, I have nothing to lose. If you ask me a question, I'll give you an answer." The most of the time, Peter, is that sometimes, well, not most of the time, but sometimes people don't want to hear the answer. They would prefer that I say something that isn't true, or, you know, script the issue, or say something that they want to hear, but I'm beyond that at this point in my life. I did that a lot when I was in the 70s when I was recording, you know, so I'm a little bit more liberated now.
Well, that's certainly a plus, actually, on this show. We like to deal with the realities, and we want everyone to feel comfortable and to talk about themselves. We're all pretty much flat. Before we jump right into the music, there are a couple of questions I sped you through toward the end of the show Monday that we really didn't go into any great depth, and that is about the movies. Now, you did soundtrack two songs for Thank God It's Friday. How did you get involved in the movie Thank God It's Friday? Because that was a huge hit.
Well, really simple. It was part of my deal with Casablanca. When the record company that I was recording for here in New York City, Pyramid Records, Pyramid Recording Company, they were an independent record company here in the city. But by the time my second album came out, The Tea Dance, they realized that they really couldn't handle. They were a real tiny label. And they didn't think they could handle my career, which seemed to be like mushrooming at the time. And so they wanted to keep their end of the production situation, but they didn't want to press and distribute records because they didn't feel they had the facility. So a deal was made between Pyramid Recording and Casablanca Records in the end of 1976, early 1977. And at the time, Casablanca was huge. I mean, it was the biggest independent record company in the world. It had Donna Summer, it had Kiss, it had, oh please, on and on, it had Cher. It was a giant. Village People, on and on. They just owned the charts. And their biggest foray in the music business was their disco business. And so when the deal was made for me to make that transition from Pyramid to Casablanca, it was right at that very moment that they were putting together the soundtrack for Thank God It's Friday. And I remember the guy who headed up Pyramid said, well, what, you know, you're going to be going over to Casablanca and you'll be leaving, blah, 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 blah. And I remember I got on the plane. I lived in New York City, and they had made arrangements for me to move to the West Coast and have a place there, whatever. And I arrived in Los Angeles. The night that I arrived, a limousine picked me up, and it took me to a party in Beverly Hills, and all the people from the movie and film division of Casablanca was there, and it was a party. The lawyers who were putting together the deal for Thank God It's Friday, you know, it's all lawyers, and it's, you know, I wonder how they ever get to make a movie in Hollywood. It's so much about everything else. But, you know, the people from Motown was there, and Diana Ross was there, and Donna Summer was there, and it was a thrill. I mean, it was really like a dream come true. I landed in Los Angeles, and the limousine picked me up and whisked me to a party in Beverly Hills. And Neil Bogart walked over to me, who was the president of Casablanca, and he greeted me, and he said, you know, you're just in time. We're deciding on what's going on to the soundtrack. Do you want to write a couple of tunes? And I was supposed to begin the third album, with Bob Esty at the time, the Confessions recording. So that was postponed for a couple of months while I wrote the songs for Thank God It's Friday. And that's how it happened. It was just one thing led to another. It was very exciting. And I remember very well. And it really was. It was like a fantasy. It was just like this fantasy come true. I mean, all these stories that you've heard about Hollywood and movies and Beverly Hills and limousines, and it was all there, and it was all very real for me for the next 3 years while I was out in California with Casablanca. So that's how it happened. It was just part of, it just became a part of the transition from Pyramid to Casablanca.
Well, what were the tracks that you wrote for the movie, and also how did they explain to you the scenes that they would appear in? Did you have some prior knowledge?
It was real simple. One of the tracks was called Do You Want the Real Thing, and they had already shot the scene, and they had used Love to Love You Baby soundtrack there already. They had like at the time it was like a click track with a beat per minute kind of situation when they finally decided on the actual song, they would then just drop that into the soundtrack. And so they said, well, here's the scene. It's the scene of the disco. It's late, sleazy. The song we have in place now is Love to Love You Baby, so we'd like to have you do something with that BPM. And so that's the approach that you have to take to that tune. And the other tune, they had already done the sequence of the guy in drag in the men's room, or in the ladies' room. I forget what, it's been a long time since I saw the movie, but there was one scene, I think it was a guy getting dragged to go out on the dance floor, and he was putting on his makeup and his girdle or something in the men's room. I don't know. I think it was the men's room. And they had to click that track, and they had the beats per minute, and they said, and here's this guy, you know, part of this disco, and he's getting into drag, and he's going out, and blah, blah, blah. And so I figured, you know, okay, no, I have to write something static. So I wrote, you can always tell a lady from the company she keeps, you know, and that was pretty much about, you can always tell a real woman from a drag by the things that she does during the night, if you listen to the lyric, you know. And so those are how they came about. I was pretty much directed, you know, as to what they wanted me to do, how fast the tunes were supposed to be, and pretty much a lyrical concept. So just wasn't all freeform. I had a direction to go in.
Well, that's very interesting, actually, that they specified it down to the BPM. I guess the guys cutting the movie knew exactly.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, down to the BPM, sure.
And there was another flick. Go ahead.
Oh, I guess that they have these, you know, especially with that film, was so music oriented. That's the way they did it, you know. That's the way they did it. And you're going to ask about Sergeant Pepper. Sergeant Pepper was one of those things. They just got every big name in Hollywood to make an appearance throughout the film. And I mentioned the other night that, you know, these weren't the speaking roles or anything. They were just, you know, cameos, or, you know, on screen, off screen, just so they could add another name to the credits, the roles, the credits.
So you didn't sing. I was trying to figure out.
I remember when I said I was in Sergeant Pepper, my mom went to see the movie. She said, I didn't get to see you. I said, oh, yes, I was there.
My name's Elizabeth. I'm there at the very end of the crowd scene with all. I'm right there next to Carol Channing and Frankie Valli. So it was that kind of thing. And the same thing with Can't Stop the Music. Alan Carr, who was the producer, was a big fan of mine. And although I didn't have a speaking part in the film or anything, he really loved my music. And I didn't know that. You know, at the time, I didn't know it. And the film was put together, and then my friend Felipe Rose from Village People. I'm still friendly with a couple of people from Village People, Felipe and Randy Jones, the original Village People, the cowboy, lives around the corner from me here in the city, so and we're still in touch. And I remember Felipe said to me, I didn't know, Alan Carr was such a big DC the Roof fan, because he wants to put you in the scene when the office of the Neil Bogart character and the various, but it wasn't anything super a cameo, you know, and something to add to my resume. I was really just out there to make music. It sounds glamorous, but it was real, just, you know, cut and dried.
Well, one thing I neglected to ask you Monday, and she's one of my favorite people, Sharon, how many times have you been loved before, Red? Apparently, you've worked with her. I'd love to hear your impressions of Sharon Sharon Red and some of the, do you have any stories about her? She is remarkable.
Well, she was a tremendously talented